Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Safety Insurance, offering a variety of home insurance products to cover your home's increased value. You can ask an independent agent about Safety Insurance. Safety Insurance will help you manage life's storms. And Revision Energy. Sunbug Solar is now part of Revision Energy, a solar installer committed to being a renewable energy partner for New England and working to fight climate change. Learn more at sunbugsolar.com.
I'm Jim Browning, ahead on Boston Public Radio. Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal called it a stunning achievement. Democrats and Republicans united in their disgust at the monopoly and manipulation on the part of Ticketmaster, all on full display at yesterday's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. We'll open phone and text lines at 877-301-8970. What is it about Ticketmaster and Taylor Swift that we can all unite around that we can't say for, say, guns, voting rights, things like that? And are you shocked to find yourself nodding in agreement with Josh Hawley?
I'm Marjorie Egan. After that, what happens when the AI tool known as ChatGPT starts getting listed as an author in medical research journals? And did you know there's lead in baby food? We'll get thoughts on both from NYU medical ethicist Art Kaplan. All that and more ahead. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. You know, Henry just said that tonight we are airing live Michelle Wu's State of the City speech. Speaking of Mayor Wu, next Tuesday we have a hell of a show here.
We do.
At the library, noon to 1, we have Ask the Governor, the first Ask the Governor for the new governor,
yep.
Maura Healey. And 1:30 to 2:30, no, that's not a typo, 1:30 to 2:30 will extend a half hour. It will be Ask the Mayor. So it's a twofer on Tuesday. The governor, noon to 1, the mayor, 1:30 to 2:30. And one last thing, that's going to be a great day. Last night was a great night. I just want to mention in passing, Marty and I were both at a tribute last night to our former boss, John Abbott, who is has left, moved to California, ran GBH for a long time, WGBH for most of it. Susan Goldberg obviously has taken over, and she'll join us in February on the radio to talk. It was a tremendous night, and it's worth spending a second to say what a brilliant job John did and what a fabulous person John is.
Oh, he was a brilliant leader at GBH for a long time. We're all going to miss him, and most important, Jim, what? He hired us.
He did. You know,
you're out of
everything
a job,
is about us, but I have
us.
To say, I didn't even think of that, but that is easy for Jim
I
to
did.
Say.
It was very important to me that he hired me.
Good. Good luck to John. He listens a lot, too, from California. So
yes, he does. He
call
told
in.
Me he
the number is 877-301-8970, John Abbott. He said
talks
he
to Alexa, Jim, and tells us to turn
does.
Us on.
In any case, bipartisan action in Congress doesn't come easy. I think you all know that. Drought and Marjorie just yesterday discussed the futility of trying to get meaningful action on guns, for example, in a nation ravaged by mass shootings, or for that matter, voting rights or abortion or anything else. But a Senate hearing yesterday had lawmakers like falling all over each other in rare form. They were not only prepared, they were in agreement. The Ticketmaster and Live Nation merger back in 2010 resulted in a behemoth company with outsized control of the events ticketing market. So why does Congress care now? Bernie Sanders, for example, spent much of his Senate career railing against monopolies. But in the end, we might have a millennial pop star and her horde of loyal and outraged fans to thank for this. Everybody remembers Ticketmaster crashed during the pre-sales for her tour, Taylor Swift, obviously, caused the company to cancel the general sale and prompted ticket prices to skyrocket on third-party resale sites. I want to make sure this was not a typo, up to $22,000 for a single seat. So the phone and text lines are open at 877-301-8970. We're asking you, are you just glad Congress is finally agreeing on something? Or does it offend you that this is the something? Do you care about this as much as your senators appear to? Have you, too, been victimized by high ticket prices, outrageous service fees? Or have you opted out of the service altogether, resigned to, I don't know, stay in your apartment, stream concerts online instead of going to them in person? 877-301-8970. Can I just play a little sound that gives you the feel?
Absolutely.
If you didn't see this hearing. Here are a few of the lame Taylor Swift jokes dropped by Republicans and Democrats alike at yesterday's hearing. First, you'll hear Mike Blumenthal? Is it Mike? No, it's not
Richard,
Michael.
Richard
Blumenthal, I'm sorry, from Connecticut. Amy Klobuchar from Michigan, and she's a Democrat. And Mike Lee, who's a Republican from Utah. It's just a little taste.
May I suggest respectfully that Ticketmaster ought to look in the mirror and say, I'm the problem. It's me.
To have a strong capitalist system, you have to have competition. You can't have too much consolidation, something that unfortunately for this country, as a ode to Taylor Swift, I will say,
we know all too well. Okay, Amy Klobuchar. Here's Mike Lee.
As of a few months ago, to get the gavel back. But once again, she's cheer captain, and I'm on the bleachers.
I'll tell you something. I can't take it. It gives it, literally, I feel like creeps running through my whole body. Not only that they're like, you know, sycophantically cozying up to Taylor Swift in the hope they'll get a text afterwards or a call or something, but that they care so – this is an important issue, by the way. But in the grand scheme of things, it's not as important as the issues they avoid, but this one they care a lot about.
Well, we can weigh in. I think our staff has told us before that the Taylor Swift All Too Well song is about her romance with Jake Gyllenhaal. So if anybody can confirm that during this next 20 minutes, I'd love to hear about
that. It is a great song.
It is great. So that's a 10-minute song, right? The 10-minute song. So Tommy from New Hampshire just emailed, or just texted, I should say, 877-301-8970. And said, we're absolutely right. These idiots are more concerned about Live Nation Taylor Swift tickets, not a word about the mass shootings in
totally
the last
true.
Week. Maybe some people have spoken about
No, you didn't read the end of his text that says just a bunch of effing idiots.
Well, he did.
But I mean, it is totally true. Do you remember when the steroid hearings in baseball were happening?
Yes.
And I don't remember if it was members of the Senate. Now, I mean, one of the most prolific takers of steroids is Roger Clemens, who literally looks like he's ready to explode whenever you look at him. You know, it's Bonds' head and Clemens' whole body. They're just incredible. I mean, great players, never even before or whatever. But do you remember that some members of the House or Senate, while he's testifying and clearly is lying about everything around steroids, asked for his damn autograph? These are little star you-know-whaters, these people.
Yep.
And that's what was happening yesterday. And
I
by
know.
The way, I hope they do fix the problem. And by the way, if you have solutions, I have a solution to the problem. Don't allow any reselling of tickets. Then the bots wouldn't come in and buy huge swaths of them. And I know it killed things like StubHub and places like that. But if there's no resale market, then there wouldn't be this kind of problem. Not to mention the fact that it does seem when a company controls a ton of artists, a ton of venues, and the ticket sales, it's a bit of a problem.
How disappointed do you think our fellow Congress people were that Taylor Swift herself did not make an appearance yesterday? They had this musician, Clive Lawrence. I've not heard of Clive Lawrence.
Nor have I.
He maybe is a very talented guy, but I did not hear him before. I read the stories about the hearings yesterday. Remember when Angelina Jolie came into Congress to give
a
talk?
I do, indeed.
My goodness.
Well, do you know what happened?
They were all in their seats very early on.
The fact that Taylor Swift did not come, do you know my response to that is? It's not all too well. That is the, I mean, this is the lamest. I know I engage in low-rent humor quite often. I will plead guilty to that. But I'm not a United States senator. All I do is I co-host a radio show on GBH Radio. I mean, these people are... And let's see, by the way, despite the enthusiasm and the bipartisan enthusiasm, let's see if they actually do something as opposed to just appear to have unity. And we want to know, do you care about the underlying problem? If you do, do you have personal experiences with nightmare scenarios around tickets? And secondly, are you not offended, as I am big time, that this is the issue where they have this much enthusiasm, this much investment, and this much willingness to cut a bipartisan deal? Marjorie's looking at me oddly.
Blumenthal said at the start of these hearings that it was amazing that congratulations might actually be in order because this is the first thing Republicans and Democrats have agreed on in months and months, if not years and years.
Well, I mean, they did a little bit on guns, and they did a little bit on this, but this is the enthusiasm level. You know, I have to say, and then we'll get to the calls, had it not been for the puns, had it not been for the borrowed lyrics, I wouldn't be okay with this, but I'd be okay-er with this. But how proud of themselves. Did you see any video of this? Each of them was sort of like, you know, you can see, I did it. I got the lyric in there. I'm acting like all those young constituents that hate me. They're going to vote for me now because Mike Lee called them Swifties. I mean, Oh, my God.
They were all going to wear cardigans in honor of her song, but they restrained themselves on that front.
Okay, let's Kaylin
take some
calls.
From Denver, thank you for calling.
Hey, Kaylin, what's up?
Hey, both. I think probably the biggest reason why both sides of the aisle are so enthusiastic is probably both sides of the aisle couldn't get tickets to Taylor Swift. Kids or family
for the kids, right?
Going to have prevent this future dilemma from happening. God forbid they're going to do whatever they can to prevent it. I also fell victim peripherally to the epidemic of Taylor Swift end of last year. My girlfriend's sister, a couple other friends couldn't get it, and boy, was it a collective depression on the side. So if whatever we can do to break up this monopoly and prevent that from happening in the future, I'll support both sides of the aisle as well.
So I'm with you, Kaylin. Thanks for the call. By the way, I think the first point that Kaylin made may not be wrong. Namely, don't you think a lot of these senators, and the ones we quoted, at least Lee to a degree and some of the others, are fairly young. They may have young kids. They try to get tickets, and the kids are saying, you're a United States senator. You can't get a ticket to a Taylor Swift concert. You know, I told you my younger daughter bought me tickets as a gift to Springsteen in March Garden. She was up from, I think, 11:30 p.m. till 3 a.m. resubmitting. I don't think there is a solution for that, because the bots buy so many of the damn tickets, there are fewer left for everybody else.
You know what it's like?
What?
Remember back early days when we were all hysterically trying to refresh our computer every 2 seconds?
To get a COVID vaccine. Is that what you're going to say?
Yes.
It's exactly what it was.
You know, and the people, the middle-aged kids that had the 80-plus parents in the nursing home or something, they couldn't run the machine. You know, they weren't familiar with technology, and they're up all night long trying to get their parents a vaccination.
Well, don't you remember those two women, by the way?
One of whom was
on maternity leave who fixed with the state. I mean, in Charlie Baker's credit, ultimately, after his hair being on fire. Remember, he was here the day the system crashed. He did fix the system. But those two women led the way while they're on maternity leave. Let's go to Alan in Charlton. We're talking about the hearings yesterday on Ticketmaster in front of the United States Senate. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm a Patriot ticket holder, and we have to sell our tickets through Ticketmaster if we want to return our tickets.
You do?
Really?
You can't sell them privately. You can Ticketmaster, in fact, all of the ticket transactions with the Patriots, including our payment to season ticket, it's all through Ticketmaster. It's a total monopoly that the NFL has. The whole NFL does it through Ticketmaster. And so I had an event this year, it was a Jets game. I couldn't go to the game, so I was trying to sell the tickets. And the ticket starter, they suggest the price very high because they want to make a commission. So they'll say, $1,000 a ticket. The ticket list price was $195. So they'll start, charge $1,000, because then they'll make, whatever their 10% on that.
Isn't that awful?
Can't sell them at that price. So I was going in, and I did a reasonable price, and it wasn't selling. So I tried to lower the price, and as I did it, I hit a typo, and it entered it. It's like, whoa, when I tried to pull it right back and cancel the transaction, it wouldn't let me. But I couldn't cancel it. It said pending, I couldn't get back to my keyboard wouldn't work. I refreshed it, and it took me less than 2 seconds, 3 seconds. My ticket was gone. They sold it for $104. The ticket was a $195 ticket. They sold two tickets for, $200.
That is unbelievable.
There is no way to get back. You can't call the Patriots. You can't call Ticketmaster.
You can imagine
trying to call Ticketmaster and make a complaint, right? Yeah.
You know, Alan, one of the great tragedies of life in 2023 is that you can't call anybody to make a complaint. I mean, really, it's all that people's phone numbers are listed. Wait, I know they have the thing, Get Human.
Paul English.
Yes.
First $1 million to the Embrace created Get Human years ago.
That's right.
And he shows you how he doesn't own it anymore.
But it
shows you how to get to a human.
Work.
It doesn't always work.
It doesn't always work.
I used Get Human, and it didn't, I couldn't get a human.
I tried that yesterday.
Alan, can I make a suggestion? Not that it'll get you anywhere. Why don't you write to the Crafts? And why don't you send a CC to the Boston Globe as a letter to the editor? I'm sure listeners knew about this. I'm embarrassed that I didn't know
Sean
about
Murphy.
That.
Sean Murphy.
It's a great idea.
The guy that does
the consumer
scams.
Yeah.
Yeah, he might love that story, Alan.
Hey, Alan, thanks for sharing that. Check it. Give it a go and let us know how it goes. Thank you for the call. What? Good. Appreciate
it. I'm breaking news here.
What is it?
Ingrid from Somerville just emailed or texted, I should say.
Yeah.
She says she knows about Taylor and Jake. She says, Marjorie, I got you. Jake and Taylor dated, and she lost her virginity to him. Then he ghosted her on her 21st birthday.
No one knows that. Is that... She lost her virginity to Jake
Ingrid
Gyllenhaal?
Ingrid from Somerville says she has the inside scoop. I, of course, have no idea if that is true. But, of course, she was saying her father was very upset, saying you're supposed to look happy on your 21st birthday.
Yeah, in the book. And the song, yeah.
In the song, yeah. And she was sad on her 21st birthday. Yeah. So perhaps Ingrid in Somerville is right. If anybody else has more information
wait a second. Ingrid, even though we can't verify any of it, we're going to go with it. So... No one else does have to. We like that story. We'll go with that loss of virginity and 21st birthday, whatever.
You know, John from Charlotte, Vermont has a great point. It's great that Taylor Swift has catalyzed this action, but there were many attempts years ago by artists such as Pearl Jam, Neil Young, David Lowery, to name just a few, that were trying to deal with Ticketmaster and the problem of ticket prices.
Well, it's not just Ticketmaster. How about the thing with Spotify?
Right.
You know, with Neil Young leading the way, and who else? Joni Mitchell, saw a couple
Mitchell.
Others. I mean, that went nowhere, right?
It went nowhere.
And by the way, that's not to criticize Young or Mitchell or the others who are principled enough to say, you can't do my songs anymore. Obviously, they lost money doing it, but people don't give a damn. 877-301-897. We want to know if you've had problems, like Alan just did, with Ticketmaster that deserve congressional attention. And secondly, how do you feel about the attention that Congress is giving? By the way, we played a minute ago a compendium of Blumenthal, Klobuchar, and Lee, but I think Lee stands out on his own. So here is the Senate Judiciary Committee holding a hearing yesterday, focusing again on Ticketmaster's influence. Here's Republican Senator Mike Lee from Utah using a ton of Taylor Swift lyrics. How long do you think it took him to do this, to get across his point, whatever it was? Here it is.
Along with Senator Klobuchar as chair. To be honest, I had hoped as of a few months ago to get the gavel back. But once again, she's chair captain and I'm on the bleachers. So a purchaser of a ticket.
Pathetic thing I've ever
being
heard.
Able to sell it to someone else.
Okay.
Not yet.
A lot of people seem to think that's somehow a solution. I think it's a nightmare dressed like a daydream. I don't think we ought to go there.
I am telling you, that is one of the most appalling things I've ever heard. In my adult life. I mean, I know that's hyperbolic, but it is totally true.
Lori from Rhode Island says she went to live concerts monthly for a good part of her life. She is now boycotting shows that have anything to do with Live Nation and Ticketmaster. They sell mass amounts of tickets to resellers. It's legal scalping. We're talking about this in context of the hearings about the Ticketmaster and Live Nation yesterday involving Taylor Swift. You can call us or text us at 877-301-8970. Should Ticketmaster be broken up? Do you want to keep paying these exorbitant prices to go to concerts? 877-301-8970. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy. We're talking about Ticketmaster, Live Nation's monopoly on ticketing, and the Senate hearing yesterday where all the senators were totally enraptured. We have two different perspectives from Boston. Here's Corey from West Roxbury texting. While this issue pales in comparison to gun violence, it is important because Ticketmaster is another example of extreme greed ruining a joy that brings happiness to this often dark human experience. That's a very good point. But then Kim, also from Boston, says issues like this and to some extent a document gate, meaning all of the classified documents, obviously, are just distractions. If they can get us all talking about this stuff, maybe we'll forget about the fact that they're not willing to do anything about people getting shot to death at dance halls and grocery stores. Both make pretty powerful arguments on both sides of the question.
Yeah, a lot of people are complaining about trying to get tickets directly from the theater, being unable to, and could only find the tickets on Ticketmaster.
A lot of people saying about Hamilton, by the way. Which
people are saying,
we were lucky enough to see
about Hamilton, and I find that unfortunate as well, because Hamilton is a great play.
Well, a lot of these things are great, Marjorie, and a lot of people are into them, and they can't get into them is the bottom line. 877-301-8970. You know, this reselling deal, one of the defenses when this issue arose, not the crashing of the system, was Springsteen tickets, and some tickets were selling, I think, on Ticketmaster for, what, $4,000 or $5,000? Mm-hmm. Springsteen's sort of honest defense was like, well, there are two choices. Either the secondary market is going to charge the $4,000 or $5,000, and the artist, meaning me and my players, get nothing, or we charge it and we get it, because this is what the market demands. I mean, there are a whole bunch of problems that need solving, but it seems to me if the demand was lower by getting the bots out of the system, which lead to the resales at exorbitant prices, at least we would have begun to deal with the problem. Then maybe they do need to break up this. You know, by the way, there was a deal with the Justice Department under Obama that appears to be pathetic when Live Nation and Ticketmaster merged, and it appears there's noncompliance. In fact, the Justice Department, I think I read, found noncompliance in 2019 and appears is doing absolutely nothing about it, you know?
Well, I think monopolies in general, Jim, are a very bad idea. Someone was comparing Ticketmaster to Standard Oil and complaining also about the fact that they take an incredible amount of money from the artists.
Well, except I'll give you a monopoly. I generally agree with you. I'll give you a monopoly where you save money most of the time.
What's that?
Amazon. You get really low prices. And to say, I mean, is there more of a monopoly than Amazon?
Well, wouldn't you argue that one of the reasons you get low prices from Amazon is because they're so huge?
That's cool. And the monopoly. Well, monopolies are huge. Live Nation and Ticketmaster are huge. As a general rule, I am totally with you. There just happened to be an occasional. I'm not saying they're not making a ton of money. Obviously, he's one of the richest men in the world. In any case, let's go to Alex in Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi there. I'm calling because I'm a local musician, and I'm playing a show this weekend. And I bought tickets for my family, and a part of the price were all of these fees, ticket booking fee or whatever it is. And, you know, we're making money from ticket sales by the door, and none of these fees are included in our pay compensation. And were there more services, maybe some of these fees would go away, but it really just gouges musicians out of their compensation.
Mm. Yeah.
You want to say what where you're playing and who you are so maybe we can help you even if Ticketmaster isn't?
You know, I'm not the artist. I'm just backing up the artist. And as such, I wouldn't want to reveal that information without the artist.
That's fine. Alex, we're glad you called. Hope the weekend is good. By the way, Marjorie, a texter corrected you, or corrected Ingrid. It was not Jake Gyllenhaal. It was George Santos, actually. 877. I'm sorry we got that. Marjorie got that wrong. I did not get it wrong.
Oh,
Marjorie,
that's a horrifying thought.
The 877-301-8970 is the
Michelle
number.
From Milton. Hi.
Hey, Michelle.
Hi.
Hi.
So a couple of years ago, Ticketmaster had some class action lawsuit, and a bunch of people who had purchased tickets got credits, and they were supposed to get free tickets. And so you had all these, like, weird credits and things in your account, but when you tried to use them, it was only for certain concerts or certain events, and it was for basically nothing. I don't think I ever found an actual event that I could use these credits or tickets to. So I don't know what that was for, or if anything ever came about that, but obviously they have been dealing with this for a long time and been trying to address it, but that obviously wasn't the way.
Do you know about that because you've had issues with them in the past?
I got them sort of randomly, I believe, as did a lot of friends of mine that had purchased tickets, so it must have been some class action suit that if you bought tickets to something during a certain time period. And I must have had probably, like, I don't know, a bunch of free tickets and a bunch of credits, but they were never able to be used. There was all these caveats, and we could never use them.
Well, by the way, I'm willing to give you free credits if you can't use them either, but it's not just them. That's a great deal. Michelle, thank you for the call.
Listen to this text. I work in the alcoholic beverage industry, mm-hmm. and Live Nation puts heavy restrictions on what alcoholic beverages and serving sizes can go into their venues. Oftentimes, this prevents local brewers and distillers from being represented locally at music venues. Wow.
Yeah. Well, that's a monopoly.
You know, we should point out, by the way, that they didn't get anywhere yesterday in Congress. I mean, they didn't come to any.
Right. We have no idea if they're going to do anything.
Yeah. There's no easy answers here, and it's not clear they're going to achieve anything.
Well, I think there are some easy answers, as I said. I mean, I'm not saying it's a whole solution. is, you know, they're complaining. The head of the company, I can't think of whatever his name was, talked about bots. Well, obviously, bots are part of the problem. It's not the whole problem by a long shot. That would fix part of the problem. Do something. By the way, we almost never do the following. But as that caller was just talking, I was rereading the incredible, cringeworthy comments from Mike Lee, the senator from Utah. We almost never play the same soundbite twice in a segment, but it is so noteworthy. Do you mind if we play it one more time?
Not at all, Jim.
Good. Here he is, Republican Senator Mike Lee. You probably met him during one of the Supreme Court. He's on the Judiciary Committee. One of the Supreme Court confirmation hearings. You never heard him with this level of enthusiasm or this level of preparation. Here he is citing more than one Taylor Swift lyric. Here it is.
Along with Senator Klobuchar as chair. To be honest, I had hoped as of a few months ago to get the gavel back. But once again, she's chair captain and I'm on the bleachers. So a purchaser of a ticket, being able to sell it to someone else. A lot of people seem to think that's somehow a solution. I think it's a nightmare dressed like a daydream. I don't think we ought to go there.
You know, I have been occasionally accused of having no shame. That I will say and do anything to whatever. I could not do this. I mean, and if I can't do it, it is really, really hard. He said this with a relatively straight face, yep. And there he is.
Listen to these texts. I long for the days when you had to stand in line outside Sears and get a printed ticket from Ticketron.
I remember.
That's from
Ticketron, right.
Ticketron. And someone else texted and said, I got tickets to Monster Jam, $30 each, plus $25 in fees from Ticketmaster, almost more than the damn ticket.
Is Monster Jam the big trucks that they run up on hills? And
I don't know what it is, but anyway, they got the tickets for $30 plus all those huge fees.
877-301-8970. We'll try to squeeze in one or two more. Where do you want to go, Marguerite?
Sue from Ipswich. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi, Jim and Marguerite.
Hi.
I'm so excited to talk to you.
Thanks.
My daughters were part of the whole, yay. They were part, Wallace and Mel were part of the whole Taylor Swift, you know, up all night and tears. And we got phone calls.
Oh,
one daughter was stuck online. And I'm not having an answer back, but I paid like the money. And I'm like, don't worry. We'll call the American Express lawyers and we'll get them to, you know, back this up. We're going to have to bust Live Nation on this. And it was this whole family drama. But when they were done, they got four and they invited me and Jamie, her dad, so that we could all have a family outing to Taylor Swift. It's just like a whole thing. I don't know how I'm going to get out of Foxborough now, but that's something else. So we definitely have been at the heart of this, and we gave them Taylor Swift ornaments this Christmas, and it was, you know, Mary Swiftmas, and the whole thing was a total theme.
Mary Swiftmas.
And finally, Mary Swiftmas. And I'm going to say, Congress should throw a free live concert on the Mall, get the artists, blow out Live Nation, and just like put it in their face and show what a real concert can be.
No, I think they should get into the concert managing business, Congress, because they're doing what they do so well. Hey, Sue, your family story is a great one. Enjoy and let us know how it goes.
Hey.
What?
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marguerite.
Thank you.
Thank you very much
for
the call.
Well, that was an enthusiastic, excited call. Well, I'd be excited if I had four tickets, too, I guess.
You know, Justin Providence is reminding us of the other problems we've had with monopolies. The baby formula issue, it was due to a factory.
What was it 90% in four companies? Was that what it was?
Yeah, and we had to fly in formula from Europe.
Yep.
I mean, that's a great point, too. Anyway, monopolies in general, with maybe perhaps your Amazon exception. But you know what Amazon has done is cleaned out the shelves in a lot of stores where you go into stores now to buy things that were always there and every place. It's not just the pandemic anymore.
Things are
missing from stores. And I think part of the reason is because they're just not supplying things that people
are
buying on Amazon.
Well, also Amazon's putting tons of places out of business. Booksellers at the top of the list. But as I say, I would be fine if they broke up Amazon, but the reality is it's one of the few monopolies where you can get a deal as often as you can get screwed. You know what I mean? Who they're screwing are small independent businesses, booksellers and others.
Father Mike from Gloucester, Center for Catholic Studies, he says, we have blasphemed Taylor Swift by indicating she has lost her virginity. She's not even married. Please correct your naughty assumptions.
Father Mike, we'll connect you with Ingrid from Somerville, and you two can work it out. She's the one who suggested that what was it, All Too Well? Was it, what did she say? It was about losing
her
virginity.
Yeah, remember the father said something like, you're supposed to be happy.
Yeah, 21,
birthday 21. She's, I think she's waiting for the phone to ring or something.
Yeah.
For the call from Jake Gyllenhaal.
Gyllenhaal,
we don't know
too.
If it was Jake Gyllenhaal, Gyllenhaal whatever
too,
his name is. He's a very good actor, and I can see why she might have thought he was pretty cute.
Well, we're done.
We're done. Okay, we're moving on.
We're going to talk to Juliet about this and get, unlike us, get an expert opinion as to maybe what should be happening should Congress actually decide to. You said the most important thing, even though there seemed
what
to be unity actually, yesterday, who would bet that they're actually going to do anything? Are they willing to confront Live Nation and Ticketmaster?
I think we have to find out about the strength of the StubHub lobbies and the geek, whatever the geek thing lobby
Seat
is. The
geek or whatever
the
it's
people
called.
People that, that want to make a lot of money on this. I mean, maybe they're big-time campaign contributors, Jim.
Very likely.
Anyway, coming up, NYU medical ethicist Art Kaplan. Did you know there is lead in baby food? And should your doctor be charging you for emails? You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. We're joined now by medical ethicist Art Kaplan. Art is the Drs. William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Professor and founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine in New York City. Good morning, Art Kaplan.
Good morning.
Good morning, Art Kaplan. So we've been talking to you a lot about this this new artificial intelligence, this ChatGPT, which means you can just tell something, write me a story about a rainy day in Memphis, Tennessee, and then this artificial intelligence does it. Matter of fact, our local congressman, Jake Auchincloss, just apparently had this ChatGPT write him a little speech he's going to give before in Congress, and apparently people can't even tell the difference. It's so good. Tell us about the latest on this in terms of research papers and the disapproval and what people are worried about.
Well, the latest is this will be my last live performance next week. The chat.
Ours too.
Why waste time on living humans? Well, look, just as a broad comment, I'm not surprised that ChatGPT can mimic so effectively what we do. We have patterns to what we say. There's a logic behind writing a speech or writing a paper. And even our phony congressman out there, our fraud guy, you know, he follows lies that are coherent and make sense. He's like a synthetic or phony intelligence, but he's playing the same game. So what's happened is some people who don't write that well, some people who want to write for journals, are asking the chat algorithm to, if you will, edit their papers up. And that one of the questions that's arisen now is, do you give the credit in writing, as we do to authors, to the algorithm, or if you will, the robot, if you want to put it that way. And it set up this whole debate, which I think is silly. Beyond
so glad
belief.
You said that. Go ahead. Keep going.
Excuse
I'm sorry.
Me, one thing.
No,
one
let
thing,
him I interrupt.
I just want to say, this is, I don't mean Auchincloss did it. He said he was going to do it.
Talking about George Santos. He's
okay.
Not talking about
all right. I just
want to
make sure we're talking about Auchincloss.
No,
go ahead, Art.
No.
Okay.
But crediting this algorithm for contributing, the algorithm didn't come up with any ideas.
Exactly.
The algorithm hasn't got any novel data collection. The algorithm is an editor. And, you know, a lot of people do use editors when they write papers, and they don't make them co-authors. They just say, thanks. And you could acknowledge that you use the program if you want to, what we call a little footnote or an asterisk at the end of the paper. But this whole move to make this algorithm our friend, our buddy, our human equivalent, it's just not, it's not there yet. It's just grinding along, using a lot of information to mimic what we do.
You know, by the way, I'm so glad you said what you said so we can move on from this. I have no problem as long as it's attributed in some fashion, obviously not as an author. They didn't contribute any scholarship to it. If the issue is the content here, not the writing, then there's nothing wrong with having a contribution from ChatGPT. The problem arises when the writing is the thing, or at least part of the thing, which is not an issue in a scientific paper. So let's just move on.
I think you do a double byline, Jim. You could
don't. You do not do a double. Oh, you're joking. I'm sorry. Okay. Sorry. Okay. Sorry. Got all excited over nothing. Okay. There's a big to-do about the fact that we can now email our doctors, at least a lot of them, and I do mine. I'm more than they'd like. I know it's a real shock, Marjorie, on my chart, which is a secure. Well, stop laughing, will you? I got
Jim
a lot
is the
of
reason,
issues.
Jim is the reason that doctors are going to have to charge for this because he's overwhelmed the six doctors he has on speed dial.
Okay, I have a few on retainer, but you know the issue is should the doctor be able to charge or not charge? You know, should it be covered by insurance? And I don't think it's that complex. Please correct me if I'm wrong. I accept the notion that it's a slippery slope and you have to be careful. It is really convenient rather than having to go in or go through somebody. You get an answer when the doctor or physician's assistant is free. If it's a minor question, like can you renew my prescription or re-up it, fine, have it free. But if it takes a decent amount of the healthcare professional's time, it should be charged at a modest rate and hopefully covered by insurance. Am I a traitor to good causes or no?
Next topic.
I mean, I guess I am. Huh?
I think that's a little bit of a softball. So what are we whining about with this email exchange? It's like if you take, 15 minutes babbling back and forth about your bunion or whatever it is, charge. If it's like, could you please re-up my prescription and it's 12 seconds, I don't have any need to see people. You're turning them into lawyers. They're going to bill by the minute. That's what happens in the legal profession. They charge every second. But I don't think that's the way to do it in medicine. And by the way, some of the emailing can save the doctor a little bit of time.
Yeah.
So that certain information is there when you get there in person.
Is there a reimbursement issue with this? I'm not.
I don't think insurance is going to pay for this. Insurance really pays for time. Insurance pays for procedures. So that's a problem within reimbursement.
Wait a second. But if it turns out it's part of your treatment,
The way this would go is something like prescribed, anti-anxiety medication to Jim, these pills, and they cost X, and it included in that package of the prescription would be the time to do it, if you will.
Okay. We're talking Art Kaplan.
So, Art Kaplan, this is one of the most upsetting stories I've read in a long time for anybody.
Well, we're 0 for 2, so keep going.
Yeah, okay. that the FDA just announced proposed limits on the amount of lead in baby foods after years of studies showing that too much lead, or any lead possibly, can pose a risk of neurological and developmental problems for young kids. And this is after deciding back in April that they have to set limit on arsenic in rice cereal for babies and infants. I mean, what? And juice that babies drink. I understand that supposedly Jim looked it up today because the story incredibly didn't explain why there's any lead or any arsenic in any of these foods. And I guess it could come from contaminated sources. But why is any lead or arsenic allowed at all? And what has the FDA been doing for years and years and years?
Now we're reaching for 0 for 3. This falls under a technical category in ethics. We call it mashugana. This is, completely ridiculous. Of course there shouldn't be lead in baby food. And by the way, Margie, did you notice what they said was they were going to get it reduced by 25%?
Yeah.
How about zero? That would be nice. Not leaving it 75% of whatever's in there now left behind. So here's my comment on this. I think, yes, we should get all this, anything that's dangerous out of baby food. That makes some sense. And I believe that what we are looking at is an FDA that's overwhelmed. So I'm going to say, and others have said it, it's time to split the food division out from the FDA and let it give it the proper person power and the authority. And let's not mix food and drugs. That's an old, old idea when the FDA was formed and it wasn't as busy. We can't have situations where we keep having all these outbreaks and contaminated food and this sort of thing. So I think the solution is let's create a food division and a drug division and give the resources to the food division to protect people. You know, I used to laugh. Some of my friends, when they had babies, were making their own carrots and
grinding
up their own baby food. And I used to think, come on, that baby food that's in the store is safe. It's wonderful. It's got to be just as good. But, well, I think they were right.
Thank God my little granddaughter is getting her own food ground up, the adult food, and not buying any baby food. But you know something they said for years, years this has been going on.
Yeah.
As everybody knows, that's why people are so afraid of lead paint in houses.
Of course.
Or sometimes if you get the lead paint.
And by the way, we had to get the lead, remember, we're ancient enough, out of gasoline.
That's right.
It was leaded gas for a long, long time, which had its own...
But you know what? I'm so glad you brought up what you just brought up, Marjorie, because I am old enough to. I was actually a tenant lawyer at the time that New York City banned. You couldn't rent an apartment. I'm going to get this mostly right. Couldn't rent an apartment if you had a kid under six, I think.
Right.
Unless it was lead paint free in New York City. And now it's almost the case everywhere. So it really speaks.
But there's
a
problem with that, too.
What is it?
The problem is that, and I've done stories about this in the past, that these companies that come in supposedly to remove the lead.
Oh, just cover it up?
It's dust.
Oh,
it's
you're right.
Everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can be I've done stories about children that were poisoned after the supposed lead removers came in because the dust was all over the grass or the dust was in the house. Now they think you should seal it in many cases. I'm not an expert.
My point was, and maybe I'm not sure I'm right about this, Art, let's see what you think. I'm probably 0 for 4. Is it shows the power of the pharmaceutical companies. That was like decades ago that virtually every city in America said you can't have lead paint in a place where a little kid lives. They're willing to take on the landlords and the developers. But the FDA waited till 2023 to say you have to reduce lead by 25%. That's a tribute. You're right. The food manufacturers. That's a tribute to their power, is it not?
I assume so. I can't imagine what would be leading to foot dragging other than lobbying of agriculture, big ag, and food.
It's gross.
Companies.
Well, think about, you know, people make fun of, whole food, whole wall, it's so expensive and all that. And they're obviously not perfect. But when we talk to you more and more about the stuff in food, the antibiotics and the hormones.
Yeah.
And I mean, we are putting into ourselves and our children dangerous food. Because of
I think that's a problem. And then we have a lot of agriculture that is heavy use in the animals on antibiotics and stuff. So that comes through to us. And then we've got another problem. We basically have too many spoilage outbreaks, listeria, salmonella, these sorts of things. And we don't screen well there. That's why I think you need a whole separate food division accountable for food safety, food surveillance, that sort of thing. By the way, work with the CDC for outbreaks when you get one of these things with the bad bologna or the hamburger has to be recalled and all that sort of thing. I don't think we're not set up right, is what I would say, from a regulatory perspective.
I hate to correct an expert, but there is no such thing as bad bologna. Let me just say that right now. There is no such thing.
Maybe there's so many preservatives in there, Jim, it would survive the nuclear holocaust.
By the way, we've never discussed, we're not going to do it today either, the five-second rule. Maybe we have the five-second rule with you. The one piece of food where the five-second rule, and with me it's like a five-minute rule, when a piece of bologna falls on the floor, it's like glued to the bacteria and all the other crap. Even I have an issue. We're talking Art Kaplan medical.
By the way, we do not have that problem in this house. Mark. There is a dog.
That's right. That's what they're wonderful about. So let's talk about long COVID. Apparently, lots of people, and three quarters of them are younger people, younger than 60. Are suffering from long COVID and having to stay out of work for weeks, if not more.
Can I add a statistic to this before you respond in this New York Times story? 71% of people with long COVID were unable to return to work for 6 months or more, 18% for more than a year. I mean, that is huge. I mean, talk about shortage.
Huge.
It's huge.
Yeah. And again, since we've all given up on COVID, I mean, right to the White House down to what's going on, masking in an airline, or I think we talked about my trip.
Mm-hmm.
last week to the Middle East, and no one was masking or doing anything on these planes. And, you know, COVID still rattling around. But I think we have completely underestimated the impact of COVID just by trying to count deaths, not counting disability, and also not counting long COVID, which we truly don't really understand. If you have it, my doctor buddies tell me they don't know what to do about it. It's not like there's a treatment. So it really is taking a terrible, terrible toll. And I think, again, public officials have just let us down on this outbreak. I'm not saying, oh, well, let's go back to all masking and so on, but the vaccinations that would have made it easier to tolerate an infection still stink. Kids aren't getting vaccinated. The elderly still aren't vaccinated. Boosters are lousy. We haven't fixed the airflow in the schools and places where we know airborne stuff flies around. Flu too, by the way. So it's really a culpable mess. And I worry about long COVID as to how long it's going to be or what the impact might be if you got it when you were a little kid. Is it going to come back and, you know, haunt you throughout your life? I don't know.
You know, is there enough I've read of clinics popping up here and there among major medical institutions to look at long COVID, to help people with long COVID. There's been some criticism of people in the medical field who don't diagnose it, but attribute it to something else, even though there's one of those codes or whatever it is now for long COVID. Are we still behind the eight ball or behind the curve here, or are we catching up with it?
We are devoting resources to tracking the impact, what people claim to be ill from long COVID. In other words, what I mean is maybe they got something else and they're confusing it with COVID because they, whatever the something else was developed at the time they got COVID. So we don't know. And we never agreed upon set criteria for coding. This person has COVID. That's why they're sick. A lot of people got coded. This person has lung problems or respiratory problems and the COVID isn't mentioned. So we're in need of ChatGPT desperately to come in there and start to sort of do a better job labeling and sorting information.
You know, Art Kaplan, this is anecdotal. It's not data, but it just, so many people have gotten COVID. Many people that have gotten all five of the shots, if they're older, or four of the shots, if they're not, have done very well. People, as you say, without the shots or not enough shots have not done so well in many cases. I'm wondering if the severity of the COVID you get, if we know yet whether that determines how likely you are to get long COVID. If you have a mild...
great question, and we don't.
We don't
know exactly what you're asking. You get a mild case versus a severe case. I don't think we know that. By the way, one place that is setting up a long-term study is here at NYU. We've got a grant, and a big grant, to track. So maybe we'll get some information in the next 6 months or a year, at least preliminary, just about that particular question, Marjorie, because right now, no, I don't think anybody knows.
You know, I have one more thing I want to bring up with you. Before I do, I meant to bring this up, and I couldn't read my writing. I'm driving last night, and I'm getting on 93 South here. And by the way, Art is a Framingham kid, so he knows 93 South.
And there's a
huge billboard that says NYU Langone something something, and unfortunately I was turning. Why is there a billboard for NYU Langone in downtown Boston?
Because you need real hospitals.
So, in other words, he doesn't know.
I don't know.
Okay, fine. Okay.
No,
one last thing for you. I never heard.
Because Art Kaplan is on Boston Public Radio,
right, exactly.
And they want people
right,
to know.
There you go. They're riding on my coattails, Marjorie.
That's right. Exactly.
I never heard of the American Society of Human Genetics, but I heard of it now, and you can tell us what it is and how the value of it. But I have to say, I was talk about behind the curve. I had no idea how much of our reputable society, and I use that term advisedly, was in eugenics. I mean, we learned from, we had Ken Burns on when he did the Holocaust thing.
Yeah.
You know, we knew some, did you know Teddy Roosevelt? When I heard Helen Keller, I almost had a stroke.
Yeah.
The Fernald School here, which I'm sure you know, Art, which I think
volunteered there.
Is that true? Well, was the I think the first in like the Western Hemisphere to be a publicly funded place to deal with developmental disabilities. They were into eugenics early on. And the American Society of Human Genetics was into eugenics too?
Absolutely. eugenics, we sometimes associate just with Nazi Germany and their race hatred that led to the Holocaust. But eugenics was all over the world. I mean, it was in Sweden. It was in liberal Sweden. It was in Brazil. Progressives thought, let's save money. Let's not encourage reproduction among people who have genetic problems. And that, by the way, included things like prostitution and alcoholism, which I don't think are particularly genetic. The abuses carried out in the name of eugenics. All the laws we have against interracial marriage, which only came off the books, you know, relatively recently, were based on eugenic ideas that scientists defended, if you will. We had plenty of eugenic ideas about trying to get, let me give you one example of this. State fairs in the U.S., I think up until the 1960s, used to have awards for the best genetic family. You know, they would have some stereotype of who looked good and healthy looking kids, and they give out prizes at the state fair to the sort of, you know, best family, quote unquote. All full of, well, let me say, I don't think anybody who's Hispanic or Black ever won that award. Let's put it that way. So finally, after all this time, nearly 100 years, the American Society for Human Genetics, which is the professional group of doctors who deal with genetics, and I believe you can belong as a genetic counselor, finally stepped forward and said, we have a history. We need to reckon with it. Mm-hmm. We have to apologize. And I know people don't always think apologies are of value, but I think it is here. And say we misused genetic information in the past. And more importantly, we have to pay attention to how it's being used now and into the future.
I have to say, I'll repeat, of all the blows that I've felt I've suffered when I've learned about people in eugenics, the Helen Keller thing, I there are no words. In any case, Art Kaplan, it's been a pleasure as always. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Art.
I'm going to get my name on that billboard.
Yeah, can you, in all seriousness, can you try to find out what the hell's going on here? It was really odd. Okay. Great. Okay. Talk to you next week.
We've been speaking with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. He's the Dr. William Meffer, Virginia Comedy Professor and founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine in New York City. Up next, after the new news, our national security expert, Juliet Kayyem. As far as we know, she doesn't have any classified documents in her garage. We're going to talk about that, as well as whether run, hide, and as a last resort, fight is still the best advice in a mass shooting. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
I'm Jim Browdy, ahead on Boston Public Radio. You've heard about them. You've heard about what they can do to shrink your carbon footprint. But when it comes to getting rebates for installing, let's say, heat pumps or that new EV you just purchased, a lot of us, including Marjorie and I, don't know where to start. Larry Creation from the Green Consumers Alliance has the answers. He's here for our questions and yours at 877-301-8970.
I'm Marjorie Eakin. For much of the 20th century, painter and sculptor Cy Twombly was upending norms and defacing expectations about what art could be. A new exhibit at the MFA is an absolute must-see. We'll hear more from GBH's Jared Bowen on that and this year's Oscar nominations. Then, fad diets and weight loss schemes. Are they all bogus? We'll talk about it with food policy analyst Corby Kummer. And then get your thoughts at 877-301-8970. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim. Hour number two.
Hello again, Marjorie. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
So joining us now on Zoom is Juliet Kayyem. Juliet's former Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security under Barack Obama and the faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Her latest book is The Devil Never Sleeps, Learning to Live in an Age of Disasters. Juliet, I hate to do this to you, but if you can speak quickly, because Marjorie has the dishwasher repairman coming at 2 o'clock today. Can you... just keep the pace up if you don't mind.
I will.
Okay,
yeah. I will.
Okay, good.
Marjorie feels very sorry for herself. She's had to wash dishes since before Christmas.
I have often said to my husband, if there is one appliance that puts me over the top in terms of life doesn't function well, it is the dishwasher. You could take my car.
Yeah.
You could take the TV. It is the dishwasher that sort of puts me over the top.
Exactly. You take it out and some of those dishes are not quite clean. You know what I mean?
Okay. Sorry I brought it up. Okay. Hi, Juliet. Good to see you.
Hi, Juliet. So this is an awkward transition, Juliet.
Yeah.
The Globe is reporting on a real horrific story this morning out of Duxbury, where two children, one 5 and one 3, found dead in a home there. A report that a woman jumped out of a second-story window and an 8-month-old is in the hospital. I know we don't know much about this, but it's very rare, I hope.
Yeah.
But
we actually don't know her relationship to the children. So we'll be careful about like whether it's the mother or caregiver. And of course, there is an 8-month-old that is also harmed, but apparently still alive. These are, you know, I'm not the first to say it, and it's not my specialty, but obviously the mental health crisis that we're under, that people are acting in ways that are just horrifying and tragic. And there was a similar case this weekend where a married couple, he's dying of a terminal illness. They make some pact that she will kill him and then kill herself. She then can't go through with it. These are like things that you don't even know how to get your head around it or even sit in judgment in some ways, because the tragedy is just so, so extensive across the board. So we'll learn more.
You know, Juliet, one last local story, though, which I hadn't thought about. Well, I have thought a lot about it, actually, but not in context of talking to you until just now. Brittany T is this woman we've heard a lot about, who's a missing person since January 10th, I think it is, in Brookfield. And this morning when I woke up, I was listening to the news, and they describe her as a missing person, even though it's been 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Is the criterion for making that determination the absence of evidence that something is a crime? I mean, if there's no evidence, a person continues to be a missing person until he or she is found or not found.
Right. Yes? That's exactly right. Okay. So just the terminology is it is actually important, because it's where you put your resources.
Right.
If you are looking for a missing person as compared to a criminal, it's just different resources, different function. They have if a pool of blood is found or something that would just suggest that she in fact is dead, then you switch.
Like Walsh.
Exactly.
Okay.
So they'll keep it open. And what we don't know is if they have reason to believe that she is still alive.
Yeah. I was listening to a little bit of the show yesterday when I was off, and Marjorie and Jared, I know, were talking about this spate of mass shootings. And, you know, while you were talking, Marjorie, I was reading some stories, and you may even have quoted this statistic. We have 5% of the world's population, yet 42% of the guns. On CNN the night before, I saw we're the only country in the world that averages more than one gun owned per person by a massive amount. I think Yemen is number 2 at 0.5. But, you know, what I started thinking about, Juliet, which we've talked to you about before, particularly in the context of this young man's incredible courage in the second California shooting that essentially accosting the shooter himself, is of late it's been run, hide, fight. And you wrote a piece mid last year saying it's time to rethink that mantra.
It is, and I remember us talking about it then, and I need to just do all the caveats of, I don't like being here. I hate being in this position. I hate that we're talking about this, that a rational society is figuring out how can you make sure only 5 are dead and not 15 in a mass shooting. But the evidence is becoming clearer that the run, hide, fight mantra, which still holds in the sense of, but is not, I would say it's not sequential. I mean, in other words, we used to, and because part of it is going to be age dependent, access dependent, facility dependent, but we used to say run, then hide, then fight. And I think what we're seeing in these incidents, close confined areas, think of Club Q, this dance hall this weekend, that if there are opportunities for civilians to engage the shooter, then take them. Because even the best law enforcement, as we saw in the California shootings this weekend, even the best law enforcement is going to still take 2 minutes. And 2 minutes with the kind of weaponry that's out there could save a lot of lives, as we saw at the second dance hall.
Yeah.
And we saw Club Q, the second dance hall, for people who haven't seen the images, a 20-something, literally, I've never seen anything like it, just goes for the...
He did.
And disarms him. And part of that is the distraction factor. If you can distract the gunman at moments that maybe he's fallen, maybe he's reloading the gun or whatever, if you can distract him, you're changing... the timing. And I recognize, so don't send me awful emails, everyone. I recognize this is insane. This is an insane conversation to have, but this is what our failed politics has brought us to, is that we're advising unarmed civilians, how do you survive a mass shooting?
But, you know, it makes a lot of sense what you're saying, tragically. But on the other hand, the cases you cite in your story, the person who confronted the gunman, at least in two cases that we know of, died. You know, we had the third guy who was armed himself and pulled out a handgun and killed the shooter, which, as you point out, got the conversation going about the good guy with the gun stuff.
Yeah.
But Riley Howell, University of North Carolina.
That's right.
2019, he charged a suspect and died. And Kendrick Castillo in Colorado, he helped his classmates, but I believe... did he survive? I think he was killed as well.
He was killed as well. So let me tell you, this is not without its consequences, and it is dangerous. It is just, it is a reflection of what, you know, I am describing what the evidence is showing me. I can't judge it, because in that moment, I don't know what opportunity, you know, at the next moment, I don't know what opportunity there is. And as I've said in my writings, I'm not about to, like, you know, I'm still telling my kids to run if they can. I don't want my kids. I don't need my kids to be the hero. And I'm completely aware of the hypocrisy of that.
Marjorie, did you, yes, so you and Jared played a little sound from Anderson Cooper's interview with the guy.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Can I just, for those who think, and I'm among them, that I would never have the courage to do what this young man did, and I hope I'm wrong, listen to the painful honesty of this guy about talking about fear and courage and how they're interconnected. It was just a beautiful interview.
He said he froze when he first saw the gunman. He said, I don't want to lie. When I saw this gunman, I froze and I thought I was going to die. And I thought this was it for me. And then he just said something changed, an adrenaline kind of thing, where he realized that if he didn't do something, that this guy was going to maybe kill him and kill other people. And they were in a long face-off here. I mean, they showed the video on television. It was really incredible.
Unbelievable.
This young man, this much older man, fighting over this gun. He finally gets the gun, the younger man, and then he's telling him, get out of here, to the shooter, who does leave.
You know, by the way, Zoe just said in my ear, we have the sound that you played yesterday.
Oh, good.
And for people who missed it, let's hear it again. This is Anderson Cooper's interview. Yeah. He's in these settings. Incredible. Here it is.
When I got the courage, I lunged at him with both my hands, grabbed the weapon, and we had a struggle. We struggled into the lobby, trying to get this gun away from each other. He was hitting me across the face, bashing the back of my head. I was trying to use my elbows to separate the gun away from him, creating some distance. Finally, at one point, I was able to pull the gun away from him, shove him aside, create some distance, point the gun at him, intimidate him, shout at him and say, get the hell out of here. I'll shoot. Get away. Go.
Can I say one thing about that? The only problem with that bite is it makes it sound like the guy was arrogant. If you saw the interview, it was zero arrogance.
Zero.
He was just matter-of-factly saying what he was going through in his mind and with his body. It was just incredible.
But you know what I wanted to ask you about, Juliet? This man, this shooter, is 72 years old. This is very unusual. I mean, usually these are much younger men.
Well, he was 67. I think he was 67, wasn't he? The earlier one was 72. Or did I get it back?
Yeah, but still,
the two
you're not.
Okay, they're older.
Yeah.
They're
older.
Talking about that 18 to 25.
No, yes.
I was in D.C. for a briefing yesterday, and I mean, the threat. Like, you don't know if this is just a fluke, but like, you know, you sort of get it in your head that you're 18 to 25 or 35. Your demographic is the one that you're looking at, or even younger than 18. And then all of a sudden you have three, of which the guys are over 55. And you're like, what is that about? You don't know what, I mean, I'm not going to say that the things are changing, but it is worth taking note of.
Well, you know what struck me was that you get to, you're in your sixth decade or your seventh decade of life, and you've kind of managed. I mean, I'm sure there were issues. This person maybe wasn't, none of them were probably perfect people, but they managed to control themselves. I mean, you think of young men who have just, nothing has worked for them, and a lot of these people are loners and they have stuff going on, and then they take it out in a violent way. But these guys went through most of their lives not doing this, and then all of a sudden, boom.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, you know, you hear about them like they have anger issues or whatever. But look, I mean, there's one common theme here. We know what it is. It's the guns. And
yes,
we haven't the gun that was used Saturday night is what's sort of a hybrid. It was described as a pistol, but its capacity is like a semi-automatic rifle. Their magazine is used. You're going to hear a lot of people discussing this. So law enforcement says pistol, and everyone thinks, what handgun can do that kind of damage? But it's a hybrid kind of pistol that has been a part of a huge debate about whether the ability to modify handguns, which are lawfully sold and everywhere, shouldn't be better regulated.
By the way, can I just say the guy's name is Brandon Tsai. It's Tsay. And if you want to Google Brandon Tsai, Tsay, and Cooper, it's really worth your time to watch this interview.
Yeah.
It tells you a lot about certain kinds of people whose courage we're dependent upon. So, Juliet, earlier in the show, we discussed with our listeners this hearing yesterday in Congress around the Taylor Swift ticket debacle with Live Nation. And I have to say, as we said earlier, while Congress obviously has no time to do anything about guns or voting rights or anything else, it's pretty obvious they have a lot of interest in fixing the Taylor Swift tickets in the hopes
that it's a big voting demographic.
Well, let me tell you, not only is it a good vote, I think they're all were praying that she's going to call them on the phone and thank them or something. I don't know, whatever it is. It seems to me, and I'll repeat what I said before, I this is not my area of expertise, except to say I'm going to Springsteen thanks to my younger daughter, who bought tickets. She was on the phone from midnight to 3 a.m.
when they went
to get tickets literally on the roof, practically. So, but and what I said to her at the time, and I said earlier this morning, it seems to me the first solution, other than whether or not there's an anti-competition issue here with a company that controls whatever it is, 70% of the industry or something, is don't allow resale of tickets. If there was no resale of tickets, then the bots and all these things would not be buying the tickets.
What about the StubHub lobby, Jim? I mean,
I'm sorry for them, but go ahead.
Do you even, I don't go out that much, but like,
do I?
I don't even go to Ticketmaster that often. I go straight to StubHub because I assume that I can't get anything on Ticketmaster.
Yeah.
And then I go straight to, okay, I'll increase the price on StubHub. Or I'll take the extra price, and you know the kind of things I go to are not like, you know, Taylor Swift. So a lot of times it's just my laziness, but of waiting too long. But I do agree that the Senate's priorities seem a little off. Number two, if you are a
it's
Senate
a bold
staffer,
statement, Julia, go ahead.
If you are a Senate staffer or aspire to be a Senate staffer, do not have your senator do, you know, what you think are funny little quirky references to Taylor Swift
songs, lyrics. Exactly. Lyrics. We played
exactly.
that. Yeah.
That was the word I was looking for. I mean, you want
to. You want to cringe. I mean, it's.
Okay, so I'm going to. But I do appreciate you letting me talk about Taylor Swift because we were just talking about dead people all the time on my segments. Okay, so here we go. Taylor Swift and Juliette Kaya merge in a perfect universal moment, a moment of the universe. I am calling bluff on Ticketmaster's claim that there was a cyber attack. From my understanding of the testimony itself, so the CEO says we were under a cyber attack.
Right.
Everything didn't work. Cyber attack is, first of all, it's the language of war. It's the language of defenselessness, right? That you're just this poor little company that doesn't actually own 70% of a monopoly of ticket sales and doesn't have a sophisticated network. The cyber attack, quoted by, I'm quoting the CEO, did not infiltrate the network and never got to purchase tickets. So you can't blame the fact there's a bunch of bots trying to get in because you presumably, and they do, they have a system that protects from that kind of bot craziness and also has a verified human access point where you have to verify that you are in fact a human being through those crazy quizzes or identification of pieces on a website, you know, what boxes have a car in them. So I still don't get what happened because I am not buying the thing that the cyber attack is responsible. I think it was just really negligent. They didn't have the resources to put behind it. And that's sort of where we are.
Okay. So
I'm still waiting.
Okay. We'll get back to that. Juliette, here, I know this is not an original thought. Whatever. Mike Pence is the latest as documents in his house. Is it fair to say that every elected official who's ever touched a classified document has classified documents in their house? And don't get upset out there. We know that Donald Trump is different because he basically lied, obstructed, resisted subpoenas, etc. But putting that aside for a moment, everybody's got them, don't they?
Not everybody.
Presidents and vice presidents.
But I think that you know, transitions are complicated. I think I'm going to do all, you know, things are overclassified. Too much material is classified. There has to be a more rigorous process of what's leaving a SCIF or a classified area into a private home. And so there's a certain amount of negligence. So I agree with you that the real story, the only story is upon this realization, what does the person do?
Exactly right.
And that's the differentiator in terms of how you separate Trump, and it's not Republican Democrat, from Biden, from Pence, from whoever else we're going to find has these materials. So this is important, is that it's the behavior upon being told. I do want to say something about the qualitative aspects of the information, just from an intelligence perspective, and what I would worry about on the counterintelligence side about our enemies. There are rankings of order of concern, and two of those points, right? Because I literally just had to go through this training again just because of some of the work I do. So two of those points are it's closeness in time. I don't know what the right word is, but the more recent intelligence is more relevant than 8 years ago because things change very, very quickly. The second is the attitude of the holder of the classified information. Mm-hmm. Are they aware that of the information they have? Are they protecting it? All of that is relevant. So here's a better example, I think, or an example that comes from this training. I'm not disclosing anything, but you know, there's a difference between, from a counterintelligence perspective, let's say one of the most known scenarios is a single guy, he works for the US government, he's at a bar in a foreign country, he gets flirted with a girl, she seems to know a lot about what he does, asking a lot of questions. The evening ends not very The evening ends as it should end. He goes back to his room. No big deal. The question is what does he do next? And the foreign agency that is watching him doesn't care whether he sleeps with the woman today. They care whether he notifies his authorities mm-hmm. that he thinks that he was part of a trap yep. to get him to sleep with this woman and then be blackmailed. That is the relevant thing. What does the person do upon learning or being mm-hmm. a victim of that disclosure? And I think that's really important.
You know, Julia, we have to go, but Margie and I were talking last night about you, and we were talking about how much we appreciate your contribution to the show. So what we decided to do, I know you'll appreciate this, is we're going to take you out to lunch on Friday. You free?
Oh,
you free?
I'm not. I'm not ready for this.
Why? Why are you not free?
Yeah. No, she's getting I'm very honored to receive a big award.
What are you getting on Friday?
A big award with a bunch of heavy hitters.
Boston Chamber of Commerce is giving me, this is the Pinnacle Award. They are honoring a lot of wonderful women in the area. And my contributions to the private sector, public sector.
Ooh, she's
and
turning red. Juliet is literally turning red. This is a first. I love this.
I'm turning red. It is a lot. It is a lot for that. And I'm very grateful. And I do hope my work in all different sectors does help people to be ready. But it is the Lifetime Achievement Award. And this is the one that has thrown me for a loop because I'm not dead yet. And I do hope I have a lot of years of contribution in some way, shape or form. So it's a big deal.
Thank you to the chamber. And we would be there if we weren't on the air, but we're really proud of you. Congratulations.
You.
Well deserved.
Thank
it's
you
great.
So much.
Yeah. Thank you very
Juliet,
much.
Enjoy it. We'll
thank
see you next
week. Thank you very
week.
Much, Juliet. And congrats to you. It's a very big deal and good for you. We've been talking with Juliet Kayyem, who's about to get the Pinnacle Award on Friday, which is a very big deal in Boston, honoring standout women for excellence, entrepreneurship, management, and lifetime achievement. Okay. Juliet is also, of course, the former Homeland Security Assistant Secretary under President Barack Obama and the faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Her new book is The Devil Never Sleeps, Learning to Live in an Age of Disasters. Coming up, we have questions about converting to heat pumps, and
oh,
we know
I'm so psyched
you
for this.
Do too. So we're going to get people to actually know what they're talking about here. Larry Creshan, Executive Director of Green Energy Consumers Alliance, is here to help us make sense of the rebates, the process, and how much you can save. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Last week on the show, we spoke with environmentalist Bill McKibben. We talked about gas stoves, oil and gas heat, converting homes and apartments to heat pumps in an effort to combat climate change. We also talked about EVs, now that I finally have one. And it turns out we didn't know very much about actually do it and get paid for it. More precisely, to get a government rebate or a tax credit to help fund the purchase. In fact, we didn't know much about anything about it. So we got hundreds of texts from you guys weighing in and asking for clarity. Well, enter Larry Creshan. He joins us now on Zoom. By the way, sitting in front of a photograph of a windmill. It sets a perfect feel. He's the executive director of the Green Energy Consumers Alliance, a nonprofit which helps consumers to speed the transition to a low-carbon future. He's going to answer our questions and yours. And if you have questions in addition to the ones we ask, you can speak to Larry at 877-301-8970. Larry, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me. This is great.
Our pleasure.
We much appreciate you being here. And we got the green trees with the windmill, too. So
we do
very,
indeed.
Very, very, very nice. So before we talk to you about heat pumps and EVs, tell us what your organization is about, Green Energy Consumers Alliance. What is it?
We're a nonprofit organization based in Boston and Providence. We serve both Massachusetts and Rhode Island. And our mission is to speed the transition to clean energy. We do it with a variety of programs that consumers can tap into. And we advocate for better state energy policy. We think that we have to move fast, like Bill McKibben says, And we want to make sure that everyone takes part and benefits from the transition.
You know, Larry, before we ask you specific questions, and I think our listeners are probably going to have some too, about what programs are available on the state level and the federal level to help certain people in certain circumstances pay, we're going to talk about EVs and heat pumps. Everybody knows what an EV is. I'm not so sure, because we were fairly new to the game here too, what a heat pump is and does. Can you spend a minute on that, please, for us?
Sure. A heat pump is, you might want to think of it as a reverse air conditioner in the winter. It can actually transfer heat using the same kind of technology that a refrigerator uses to take whatever warmth there is outside. Believe it or not, there is more than you think, that through the magic of science, we can then heat an indoor space with that, or we can heat hot water with that, or water and make it hot. Mm-hmm. And so that technology's come a long way. A lot of the country has heat pumps in the more temperate climates. But in the last 10 years, there's been great improvement in making them effective in cold climate zones. So the Northeast and the Midwest and so forth. And fun fact, the world's leading countries when it comes to heat pumps are the Scandinavian countries. So the technology's come a long way. And it presents an alternative for people. It's non-combustion, where it runs on electricity, which is getting cleaner every day as a result, because we're adding more renewable energy and we are squeezing out the fossil fuels every day when we add a wind turbine or solar panels.
You know, all the time we learn why those Scandinavians are the happiest people in the world, Larry.
Right.
And those heat pumps are probably yet another reason.
You know, Larry, Jim said everybody knows what an electric vehicle is, and I'm sure that's true. But I just read something this morning about how we shouldn't be so happy about these electric vehicles because of the lithium mining problem for the batteries, and that if everybody goes to electric vehicles, we're going to have more and more lithium mining, which is bad for the environment and bad for the miners. So what about that?
So I read the article. I'm looking forward to reading the entire report. Our view is that at the end of the day, we cannot run cars on fossil fuels. We've got to give up gasoline and diesel fuel. So I agree with the author who was saying, sure, let's dramatically improve public transportation in Massachusetts and throughout the world. Let's promote active mobility, biking and walking. But at the end of the day, we've got to get people out of the internal combustion engine. And so I'm not saying that we need to buy more cars, but the cars that we buy need to be electric. She had another point, which was, I believe, in the report, is that, we don't want, or we can't really get by with having huge honking EVs. And I agree with that. So, we want to see cars reasonably sized. And to the extent that the feds and the state can incentivize that, we'll be better.
Okay, I have noticed where pickup trucks are getting bigger and bigger, Larry. I don't know what that's about. We seem to need ever bigger ones.
Right. That's a trend we've got to stop. I mean, one way to do it, both the feds and the state do have limits on how much, in order to get a tax credit or a state rebate, the vehicle can't cost more than X number of dollars. And because size and price tend to go hand in hand. And so if we can target incentives to reasonably sized vehicles, then I think we'll be better off. And so we're hoping to see that happen over the next few years.
So the line's filled up in about a nanosecond. So let's spend the next 5 minutes, just the three of us talking, and then we'll take your calls. Let's break it down into four things. Start with heat pumps. Tell us what's available from the feds and for whom, then Massachusetts. Then we'll go to EVs. Same deal. What's available from the feds and from Massachusetts. So on heat pumps, what's available on the federal level, Larry Krishan?
So the Federal Inflation Reduction Act, IRA, is a game changer. It has great support for heat pumps and many other things in clean energy. But essentially, it breaks down into two categories, rebates that are available and tax credits. The rebates that are available will flow probably through state agencies. In Massachusetts, it'll probably flow through the Department of Energy Resources. Everyone's still waiting for that information to come from the feds, and then to the state, has to digest it. Then the state has to stand up a program. Those rebates are very generous if your income is at or below 150% of the median income for your area. So we're waiting for those details so we know what those income numbers actually are. But for a
can you give
low,
us a ballpark on what, even if it's not precise, what is an average median income, for example,
I can
in
never
greater Boston?
Figure that out.
Do you know?
It's well over $150,000.
Oh, it is.
So
that would go to
number.
$225,000 to qualify if that's the number, the 150%.
What I meant was the 150,000 would capture the 150%.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Yep. So up to 150 grand. Does the value, the cost of the heat pump matter, or the only criterion for admission is what your income situation is?
And actually, there will be a requirement that the heat pump be a cold climate heat pump that meets efficiency standards. So it's important. The rebate's is up to 100% for a low income person.
Really?
And it's 50% for a moderate income person. And then after 150% of median income, the rest of us are eligible for tax credits of up to $2,000 for a heat pump. And what's important, and I like the way you structured this discussion, that you can piggyback the federal benefit, whether it's the rebate or the tax credit, on top of anything available at the state level. About 85% of us in Massachusetts are served by the utilities Eversource, National Grid, and Unitil. And on the Cape, it's a group called the Cape Light Compact. Uh-huh. That they make up the program that everyone knows as Mass Save. You can get a $10,000 rebate from Mass Save for a heat pump, even more if you're low income. Okay. And you can get a 0% heat loan for any out of pocket cost that you might have with that. So really what we're waiting to see, okay, a little bit more information from the feds, but I would like MassSave to put up on the website something that walks people through the federal money and the state money. But long and short of it is, when you add up the MassSave rebate plus either the federal rebate or the federal tax credit, you really begin to get to an affordable price point for a lot of people for a heat pump.
Can you do EVs quickly for us, and then we'll take some of these calls?
Yep. So EVs, same thing. The 2022 climate bill in Massachusetts created some nice new state level incentives for rebates for, it's called the More EV rebate. If you go to moreev.org, you'll see the details. They expanded it for moderate income people and for people who are buying used EVs. Mm. And so that's available, which is great. But at the federal level, what came out of the Inflation Reduction Act is a long extension of the federal tax credit of up to $7,500 for a vehicle that doesn't cost more than, I think, $55,000 for a sedan and $80,000 for an SUV or a pickup truck. And it's also income. Your income cannot exceed, I believe, $150,000 for a single payer and $300,000 for a couple. But it's the federal tax credit, to be honest with you, is really complicated. Our friend from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, drove a hard bargain and is making it so the next couple of years, a lot of cars won't be eligible because the materials that are going to make up the battery over time have to be sourced from the United States or from friendly countries. His point was, we want to get away from sourcing from Russia and China and all that, but some of the numbers are really hard to get at. So there's a list of vehicles that are eligible for the full $7,500. And there's some projections about when the others will be eligible. So it's really complicated, but it is a great time to be looking for an EV because there's more and more makes and models coming out all the time. It's a dramatic way to reduce our consumption of petroleum and whether it's gasoline or diesel.
You know, one last question before we get to the calls about heat pumps. People have been stunned this winter, and it hasn't even been that cold, about the costs of heat, whether they're oil or gas or electric. What does heat pump mean for your monthly bill compared to electric bill, gas bill, oil bill?
Yep. In general, and this is a generalization, every house is different. A lot has to do with the configuration of the house. Is it an open floor plan, or is it, you know, chopped up a little bit? Like my house is just a Cape style house. But long story short is oil and propane, people who heat now with oil and propane should look really seriously at heat pumps. You're going to drop your consumption, maybe 100%, but certainly most of it with, if you install heat pumps, you could have the oil or propane as a backup possibly. Electricity should be cheaper than the oil and propane over the life of the system. For gas, it's a little trickier. In some houses, having the gas be cheaper to run than the heat pump is a little tricky, but we're encouraging people to look at it if they have the means to do so. It is a great way to reduce your carbon footprint. But there are some houses with gas. You can get a rebate from MassSave up to $10,000. And I just said about the federal incentives. There are some homes where with gas, if you suppose you have a ducted heating system, forced warm air, you can heat your house pretty well with an affordable heat pump. And so it is worth a look. Something worth a look is if you have central air conditioning and gas, you might want to take a look at it because the central air conditioning units don't last forever. They don't last as long as a boiler or a furnace. And so if you want to replace your central air conditioning system, you should look at upping your game a little bit and installing a heat pump, which will provide you with central air conditioning and central heating. And the economics of that in that situation are pretty good. So I guess one other point I'd say to you both is, not everyone has to sprint towards all these technologies. We want to see people adopt them as soon as they're ready. But the beautiful thing about the Inflation Reduction Act is it's going to run till 2032. So we want people to plan. Try to avoid buying another internal combustion engine car. Try to avoid replacing your oil system with another oil system or your gas system with another gas system. And look at these things. Look at an induction stove next time you're in the market for a stove.
By the way, I want to do one caveat to what Larry just said about till 2034, you said. If Trump is reelected in 2024, I'd buy everything in that December of 2024 and buy it really quickly. Brian in New Bedford, you're on with Larry Krishan from the he's the executive director of the Green Energy Consumers Alliance. Thanks for your call, Brian. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
I was thinking about replacing my central air with the heat pumps. I have a heat pump downstairs. I also have radiators downstairs, baseboard radiators, and I find the radiators last a little longer than the heat pump. You turn the heat pump off, and it's, you know, I use both. I use the radiator. I turn the radiator off. It seems to warm the house a little bit, and then I turn the heat pump on to warm it up more. Do you know what I'm saying?
Supplement. Yep. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It sounds like you're doing the right thing generally. I will put in a plug for a program that we have. We do provide advice. Actually, as we speak, Loie Hayes, who works for me, is doing a great webinar on heat pumps. And so I'm covering for her. But if you go to our website and look up our heat pump program, we have partnered with Abode Energy Management, and they provide technical advice about your situation, for example. And, you know, for a nominal fee, they'll help you compare bids that you would get from heat pump installers. We really recommend that you get multiple bids, and they can look like gibberish to you when you get them. And Bode will help you compare them apples to apples. And they have got more technical expertise than I do. So I would recommend look at our website, and we've got a nice situation going on with Bode. The money, $150 to get really good advice, could save you thousands and make sure that you're warm and toasty in your home. So,
by the way, it's greenenergyconsumers.org, or Brian and everybody else. Brian, thank you for your call. Lots of luck. 877-301-8970.
Let us go to Kurt in Rowley. Thank you for calling, Kurt.
Hi, Kurt.
Hello. We have your guest Larry's last comment is sort of what I'm at. We have gas heat, central air. The air conditioner, we're told, is on its way out, and so I'm considering replacing the air conditioner with a heat pump. I'd like to keep the same heating unit, but we had our usual heating company come out, give me a quote, and he quoted replacing the entire heating unit as well as putting in a heat pump for, you know, the air and heating. And I was wondering if that's necessary.
What I strongly recommend is you get multiple bids. I keep coming back to that. Try to get a couple bids from, there are some companies that specialize in heat pumps and do a lot of heat pump installations. See what they have to say. And again, I think you're well served on the, every house is different. Abode can help you manage that situation for your home. But I think that what I do know a lot of people do is they'll retain the old central heating system as a backup. And so it's possible to have them both, but a lot of people are going the whole way with the heat pump and functioning quite well.
Thanks for your call, Kurt.
Here's a good text. I get these all the time in the mail about choosing green energy suppliers on your electric bill. This is from Heather in Medford, where you just switch on your bill. They say you don't have to do anything, but choose clean electricity. Is that a good idea?
Almost entirely no. The companies that will mail to you or call you or go to your door, you ought to just disregard in our viewpoint. We think that oftentimes they're not going to give you a good deal. The Attorney General, actually now Governor, former Attorney General Maura Healey, did 3 reports showing that companies like that that tend to overcharge people compared to what they would get if they were on the utility supply. Our organization promotes what's called municipal aggregation, which is the community is buying the energy supply on its behalf. And so that is really growing huge in Massachusetts. It's in Boston. It's in Worcester. It's all 150 communities are doing it. We're involved with that. And they're saving money compared to all the options. So the person who texted you from Medford has municipal aggregation. That is the best deal that she could find. So she's not sure about that. She should go to the website for the town of the city of Medford and find the link, and she can sign up for it. And she'll save money, and she will buy a greener product if she wants to. And that's what's cool. We ran the numbers, and if everybody in Massachusetts did that, they'd be saving about $200 million per year compared to what the utility supply is.
Wow.
And would be adding 1 to 2 million megawatt hours of green electricity. So
just to be clear, you go to your town website, just check if it has it, Medford, whatever town you live in. And what would you be looking for when you went to your town website?
The best way for a community to find a person is to find it is put in your Google, your city or town and municipal aggregation, and you'll find a link. So I do know Medford's got a link to the program, but you can also find it on the town's website.
Larry, the only reason I would assume the other 201 cities and towns don't do it is because they're too small and they can't work out some sort of a regional compact to do this. Is there any reason everybody wouldn't do it?
No, actually, we're trying to encourage, get the word out. I mean, and there's 41 cities and towns in the state that are municipal utilities, so they would not do aggregation.
I see.
But right now, we're talking to all the communities that don't have it. I don't think it's that they're not too small. You don't need to have a multi-town consortium to do this. I think some towns don't have maybe the staff to try to figure it out, but it works. We've got the data. We did a report on it. You can find that on our website. But we're kind of excited. We're talking to some of the bigger communities in the state that don't now have it, and we want to bring the benefits to that to communities. I'll name them: Springfield, Lawrence, Brockton, Randolph. There's a bunch more, and I think eventually you'll see them sign up as well.
By the way, it's MedfordC, as in Charles, EA.com is the site for that particular person. Rodrigo, you're in Cambridge. You're on with Larry Cretion. Hey.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a quick question in particular about how the massive incentives work for multifamily housing. From my understanding, it only applies to residential family units, but Cambridge defines multifamily housing at 3 or more units, but the FAQ for Mass Save seems to define them at 5 or more units. So I was curious how the incentives work for triple deckers.
For triple deckers, it would apply. Mass Save is a special program for 1 to 4 family units. I know that. So you should pay attention to the Mass Save definition. And they certainly are out there looking for that kind of property all the time, because those kinds of properties can be made much more efficient, and then we're benefiting three homes. I encourage you to go through with that and see what you get. Basically, the units each qualifying for an incentive, and the Mass Save program is really trying to entice landlords or condo owners to participate. Sometimes it's a little tough to do the building right if you're in a condo association and people are disagreeing about what has to get done, but you got to work through that.
Of course, yeah. Okay, got it. Thank you so much.
Rodrigo, good luck. Yeah. Thank you for your call. We really appreciate it.
We're talking about heat pumps, EVs, environmental issues, and we are taking texts and calls at 877-301-8970. 70 from Natick wants to know, Larry, is a mini-split considered a heat pump and eligible for rebates?
Absolutely. Different lingo, right? A heat pump is oftentimes a ductless mini-split is the term. It doesn't have ducting. It's not forced warm air ducting in your house. So they're going to poke a little hole through your wall to have the unit outside the home. And then what you see on the inside is the mini split. Heat pumps can also be a whole home, as I said, a ducted system. And geothermal qualifies too. If you happen to be in a situation maybe where you have a large lawn or something like that, or certainly new construction ought to be all electric, whether it's geothermal or air source heat pumps, those things qualify.
Can I just say, we have colossal interest in talking to Larry. We're going to keep him for about five more minutes. But Larry, can you agree right now you'll come back in a couple of weeks and continue this? Because a lot of people have a lot
swamped.
Of interest and they really need your help. You can do that, yes?
This is what we live for.
Great.
That's why we're here.
That's what we live for, too. Gene in Marlboro, you're on with this very same Larry Cretion. Hey.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a whole house heat pump installed last year and a new gas furnace. My other regular air conditioning unit died, and I decided to go ahead and do the heat pump and the auxiliary heat through the gas furnace. And my heating contractor handled the rebate for me, but the only rebate I got was from Mass Save for the gas furnace, and it was $750. My contractor told me that because they weren't the same brand, I wasn't eligible for any kind of rebate on the heat pump, and that doesn't sound right to me.
How about it?
It doesn't. If I were you, I would contact Mass Save and get the word directly from them. I don't know your situation, but it doesn't sound like the installer was really working entirely for you. Every installer in Massachusetts should know the details of the rebates from Mass Save, and that should be like a prerequisite. I know when you hired the guy, you probably expected that they would pass it on to you. But so one point I'll make is, not every heat pump qualifies for the Mass Save rebate. Maybe they installed one that did not meet the standards of Mass Save. And so what we do want Mass Save to do is, with the limited dollars that they have to provide incentives, we want them to incentivize people to adopt the most efficient kind of system, because that's what's going to save you over time, is having an efficient heat pump. So I hope it works out with Mass Save. I'll throw out my email address, larry@greenenergyconsumers.org. I'd love to hear the response from Mass Save on that one, if you could get back to me.
By the way, before you leave that, a lot of the criticism of Mass Save has been that they are gas company dominated. In fact, Mike Barrett, I guess, is chair of the Environmental Committee or whatever, Senator Barrett on Beacon Hill, is trying to change the composition of the board. So, by the way, in the spirit of full disclosure, Mass Save came into my house and did a great job of free insulation of three floors of a house. So I fared very well with them. Is there concern that you won't get the straight poop, so to speak, on heat pumps from them?
I think right now they will answer the question truthfully about why the rebate was not applied to the heat pump. But I totally agree with Senator Barrett. Mass Save is essentially run by a consortium of electric utilities and gas utilities. And I see the utilities as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The electric utility is Dr. Jekyll, and the gas utility is Mr. Hyde. The electric utility wants you to install a heat pump, and the gas utility does not. And so in order to get to our carbon goals that Massachusetts has enacted with the Global Warming Solutions Act, we have to work with the gas utility and phase them out. We don't owe their shareholders a penny. We want to make sure that we reduce our gas consumption over time to zero by 2050. We want to make sure that no workers are laid off in the process. We want to do this in a just way. But yeah, there's a conflict of interest there. If they're running the program, we probably need to wrest that away from the utilities.
Larry, thanks for that. Gene, thank you for your call. Rick in Rhode Island. Rick in Rhode Island. Hey.
Hello.
Hello to you.
First time caller.
Love those. Don't screw it up, Rick. Go ahead.
Okay, I have a question. I installed a heat pump in our home and did it ourselves.
Wow.
And I was told that I couldn't get a rebate because I didn't have a contractor do it.
Well, you live in Rhode Island, correct?
Correct.
Do you have any idea? Do you know the Rhode Island rules, regs, that kind of thing, Larry?
Yep. Rhode Island Energy is the utility there. They're overseen by the Rhode Island Public Utilities Commission, and that is probably a rule of that program. You can appeal it. I would recommend that you contact Rhode Island Energy one more time and maybe send it in to the Public Utilities Commission with a written explanation. You know, to be honest with you, what the programs do encourage qualified professional installation of anything, whether it's a heating system or a heat pump or a stove or whatever. Do-it-yourselfers can oftentimes do a great job, but you may just miss out on that one.
Hey, Rick, thank you. Good luck.
You know, just one quick question before you go. I've heard this a lot. We're getting questions about this a lot. The people are worried that when they buy electric vehicles or even hybrid vehicles, that the battery is not going to last in those vehicles, and they're very expensive. I have a hybrid for 12 years, and I never had to do anything with the battery. But in any case, what's the deal with that?
You don't mean
that?
The cheap battery. The cheap battery you may have to replace.
The EV battery, the hybrid battery that people say is going to cost you thousands of dollars to replace.
I love that question. All across the world, the batteries are being determined to being lasting longer than people expected.
Yeah.
They're not in 10, 15 years. At some point, a battery may not be able to push the car around perfectly, but the data is showing that they're doing better than they expected. And so there are good ways of maintaining battery health and all that. But here's what's cool about it. At that point when the battery, you know, might not be great for pushing the vehicle around, there's a second life to it. There will be an economic value to the battery. Someone's going to grab it and use it for stationary electricity storage, which is a big thing. We're building battery storage facilities all over the place. So we can actually collect the batteries from EVs, and maybe they'll go back into someone's home, or they'll go back into a business and serve the purpose. It might be a microgrid. It might be to help a community center have battery backup. And that will last a long time. And then at the end of the day, 20, 30 years from now, that device could be recycled. Already in 2023, they're finding ways of recycling about 100% of the material, the critical materials in a battery. So by the time your battery dies, they're going to really have that down perfect. It's funny. We actually have more battery recycling capacity in the world than there are batteries to recycle because they're lasting longer. So we're ahead of the curve on that one.
By the way, let me give Larry's website again.
Yeah. Yeah,
greenenergyconsumers.org. And you heard him say, we're very sorry, we got to go, but we will have him back
in
a couple of weeks to
back.
Answer additional questions.
Because some of us are obsessed with heat pumps. I'm one of them, I guess.
Larry, we really appreciate your time. You're terrific.
You.
Thanks
very
so much. Be well.
My pleasure. Take care. Have a good day.
Yeah,
talk
you
soon.
Too. Larry Krishan is Executive Director of the Green Energy Consumers Alliance. We thank him again for his time, and he's going to be back because we had a lot of interest in heat pumps and EV vehicles. Coming up, The Oscar nominations are out. GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen is here with his roundup. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're at the library on Friday. We're at the library next Tuesday. Tuesday, we have a twofer, quite a day. 12 to 1, Ask the New Governor. And 1:30 to 2:30, that's right, till 2:30, Ask the Mayor. That's at the Boston Public Library. Joining us now, though, in Studio 3, Marjorie's home, he's joining me, is GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen. He hosts Open Studio with Jared Bowen on GBH Channel 2. Hello, Jared.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Jared Bowen. Great to see you. I think I saw you last night, but I'm seeing you again.
Yeah, Jared was at the great thing for John Abbott last night, too. It was a fabulous event.
It was.
So let's start. How could you resist this headline? I've been waiting half my life for this show. It's magnificent. And it's written by Sebastian Smee, who used to be with the Globe. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his fantastic writing and coverage of the arts. He's talking about a Cy Twombly exhibit at the Museum of Fine Arts. Beautifully written piece. But I said to Jim before the show, Cy Twombly, I think, needs some explanation. If you are not someone that knows a lot about art, it's different.
Yeah. Well, let me just back up and say Sebastian Smee is the best arts writer in America, hands down.
It's incredible.
And I saw that headline, and I was so delighted because I felt the same way. This is an absolutely glorious show. But I think you do have to do a little work. So read Sebastian. I'll talk a little bit about Cy Twombly, and then you can see the great work that the Museum of Fine Arts under the curator Christine Condolian has done here to assemble this look at who Cy Twombly was as an artist. If you look at his pictures in a museum, they can be reduced in their simplest forms to just scribbles or drawings and can be very difficult, I think, to access or to understand. And that's why this show is so magisterial, because what they've done is show us that Cy Twombly was an artist who was always rooted in antiquity. So again, you look at these drawings and what some people have described as mere scribbles, and you think this is the most contemporary art, but he was always referencing poetry and the classics and Greek and Roman mythology and heritage. They begin with a fabulous quote in the show from Cy Twombly. He said, "For myself, the past is the source, for all of art is vitally contemporary." And so throughout his career, in the way he renders these drawings, he's even kind of mimicking the stone surfaces of monuments so that you get this kind of rough form. He's looking back at these fragments of poetry and text that have always stood out to him, and then he creates these paintings and drawings and sculpture out of these one words. He creates ideograms that represent himself, whether they're boats indicating his own passages and journeys as an artist, or the lotus flower, not necessarily for being a blooming flower, but because it represents the W in Twombly in his name. So it's very layered. It's very deep. I would suggest you take in this show by perhaps reading a little bit, take the audio tour, but also just see how beautiful it is. Because in this show, you see a lot of the influences that he had right adjacent to his work. And what they've done is he moved to Italy in 1959. They've brought some of the classical statuary that he had in his studio to travel for the first time. You'll see it in the show. So you see what constantly inspired him. He was a student at the Museum School in the 1940s. So they've gone back into the MFA collection and brought out some of the pieces, the ancient pieces that also likely had a great influence and inspiration in his life. And then it pieces together how this artist came to be and why he created.
And again, read the Sebastian Smee. We all three of us agree it's
brilliant. Oh, my God.
But I mean, I'm not even that interested in the subject matter until I read his thing, until I listen to you, and it's just incredible. I am really interested in this film. We're going to talk about the Oscars in a couple of seconds. Tell us about Living. Well, actually, let me play a little sound from Living. And I'm not going to tell you who starred in it because we'll get to him in a second. He's an older civil servant facing a fatal illness who attempts to find joy with a younger woman. And here is that character asking the younger woman out while she's working as a waitress.
Mr.
room's very busy. I'm sorry.
Yeah, of course, I'll let you go. But I did wonder where your present shift ended.
Why would you mind about that?
Why? Well, for one thing, because they're showing I Was a Male War Bride at the pictures. I wondered if you'd care to come along.
No, I shan't be encouraging this skiving any longer.
That is a great scene. Is it great in the movies? As great as the sound is?
It is, absolutely. Every scene is great in this movie. This is, it's a really moving picture. And it's kind of funny because we talked about A Man Called Otto recently. And it's
Tom Hanks deal.
The Tom Hanks movie. Yeah. And this is similar, but even, it's so finely rendered. That's how I would describe this. So it's set in the 1950s. That was Bill Nye, who we just heard.
Yeah, we'll get to him in a minute.
I think I know where you're headed, and yeah, I'm happy to hear it again. But Bill Nye is a quiet man. He reveals at one point in the film that he only ever wanted to be a gentleman. And so he has his quiet life, moving under the train every day in a certain orderly way with his employees at the very bureaucratic department in which he works in England behind him. Takes his place at his desk in a quiet way every day and then just goes home quietly. But then he gets a diagnosis that he has a terminal illness. And it's the first time quite late in his life when he decides that he has to start living. And
well, this breaks my heart. Oh my God.
It's really beautiful because when you have such an extremely talented actor like Bill Nye, whom the Academy has just recognized with an Academy Award nomination, and you see him at this stage of life trying to live and basically claw back all those years. He's not crazy about it, but he goes to a carnival. He goes to the beach. He establishes a relationship with this young woman, and it's nothing untoward. It's nothing unseemly. He just sees the vitality in her and wants to learn from her, this young 20-something-year-old woman when he's a man in his 70s, and that's the story. It's very simple.
By the way, someone just typed. Who typed that on the – Zoe – I forgot. He played the aging rock star in Love Actually. One
Billy
of the greatest
Mac.
Performances maybe ever. By the way, Jared knows we were going. We played this a couple of weeks ago, but it's so great. Jennifer Coolidge is presenting an award at the Golden Globes. And by the way, she's the Hasty – whatever the hell it's called, the Harvard
Hasty Pudding
thing. She's talking about the trepidation she had accepting the role as presenter. Here she is.
My biggest nightmare is really it's just the pronunciation of people's names. You know, once I say someone's name the wrong way, I'm screwed. I am screwed. I was at a dinner party one night with, I'm not kidding, I sat next to Bill Nye. And every time someone came to the table, I was like, this is Bill Nye. And then, I'm serious. Across from me was Kaylee Cococo. And it was just, you know, it's just a disaster.
I am dying to see the film. So I am most happy about the Oscars for a reason that I bet you are when I say it, is that Marcel the Shell with Shoes On was nominated for Best Animated Feature. Why would we be interested in that, Jared Bowen?
Maybe because Jenny Slate is starring in that film.
And Jenny told us when she was on with her husband, and they were both fabulous a few weeks ago, that there was a whole debate as to whether or not it even was an animated film, right? Because of the human kind of element in the thing, but ultimately it was, and they're one of the five nominees. We hope to speak to her, by the way, before the Oscars. What's your major takeaway from the nominations?
That they got it right. I was really impressed by the Oscars this year, and it kind of reminded me of the Oscars of years ago when people kind of got excited, because here you also, which we haven't seen in a long time, a mix of really popular films like Elvis and
Top Gun
and movies of that ilk with the art house films that we typically see, like Tar, like The Banshees of Inisherin. Marjorie and I were talking about this yesterday.
Yes.
We had a debate about whether it's funny or not.
Okay, yeah, let's stop there for just a second. Because, you know, I went to see it. I was all excited. It's an Irish movie. The acting was really great. The two actors had been before together, and the acting was really great. The scenes of Ireland were beautiful. But to say I didn't get it, I'm embarrassed to say I just didn't get it.
Well, Martin McDonagh, who wrote this film, he definitely has a very definitive sensibility and vocabulary, and it's very, very dark humor. And, I thought it was hilarious, I guess, until it wasn't, because Marjorie yesterday reminded me of all the things that aren't hilarious, like chopping off fingers and one other scene that we won't spoil.
But
it's dark.
It's very dark. But if you like dark things and great shots of Ireland and good acting, we should play some sound from the Banshees of Inisherin, is how you say it. A story about about the dissolution of the lifelong friendship between Brendan Gleeson as Colm and Colin Farrell as Patrick, set against the backdrop of the Irish Civil War and some beautiful scenes of the Irish countryside.
But I don't think I said something when I was drunk and I've forgotten it. But if I did, then tell me what it was. And I'll say sorry for that too, Colm. With all my heart, I'll say sorry. Just stop running away from me like some fool of a moody schoolchild.
But you didn't say anything to me. And you didn't do anything to me.
Well, that's what I was thinking, like.
I just don't like you no more.
Colin Farrell is so sweet in that movie. By the way, in this category, all best actors, first-time nominees.
Is
all
that
of them,
true?
Including Bill Nighy.
By the way, when you really? Said all those other films, wasn't that the whole reason to expand, which I think is ridiculous, the 10 films for best film?
I think it's ridiculous,
so you can get the
too.
Blockbusters in, even if they're not that good a movie. The movie I want to talk about for a second, because I haven't seen it, and it got the most nominations. Everything, of course, I haven't seen anything, except the Fabelmans. Everything Everywhere All
Would
at
you see
Once.
The Fabelmans?
Yeah, it's pretty. I think it's great. Did you like the Fabelmans?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh. Everything Everywhere All at Once got 11 nominations, I think, which was number one. Tell us, did you see it yet?
I did see it.
Tell us a little bit about it. Did you tell us what you thought? I hope we haven't talked about this.
No, we haven't talked about it. I only saw it this past weekend.
Give us a minute on it.
If I can. It's so difficult to describe. So Michelle Yeoh is a woman who is presiding over a laundromat, and she has to rally up all her tax information to go to the IRS and sit before an agent played by Jamie Lee Curtis, who got snubbed. She was supposed to get an Oscar nomination. I think I have that right, that she didn't get one. No, she did get one, actually.
Okay, great. I love her.
It was Golden Globes that she lost, I was thinking about. But on their way to meet with this tax accountant, her husband puts this headset on her and tells her that she basically has to follow his instructions. And suddenly she finds herself in the metaverse and in different universes where different variations of their lives are playing out. And she needs to conquer and fight people. And then I got very confused.
How long will it be before I have absolutely no idea what's going on in this film? How many minutes do I get in?
Maybe 13.
Okay, fine. So here is a little sound from this. In this clip, an alternative universe version of Wayman, our protagonist, Evelyn's husband. By the way, Yo is like the sensation of the nominees. Yeah. Everybody's talking about her. Is explaining why he needs her help to save the universe. Here it is.
I'm not your husband, and he's not the one you know. I'm another version of him from another life path, another universe. I'm here because we need your help.
Very busy today. No time to help you.
There's a great evil that has taken root in my world and has begun spreading its chaos throughout the many verses. I've spent years searching for the one who might be able to match this great evil with an even greater good and bring back balance. All those years of searching have brought me here, to this universe, to you. I know it's a lot to take in right now. Got to
Mrs. Wang!
Hello!
That was Jamie Lee Curtis saying hello. At the end, well, you may not have gotten it, but apparently the Academy, not whatever, wherever
well,
they are.
Really, really, really good performances all around.
There are.
That's what sings in this film, yeah.
Okay,
so how about The Fablemans, Jim? Why don't you give us your review?
I mean, it's like, I know what you're going to say. I know exactly where you're going with this thing. Oh, it's like little Jimmy Browdy, right? So, sorry, I know you so well, Marjorie, so I'm not going to fall for that BS. When Jared's seen it, we can talk about it on the thing.
Okay,
time I'm here.
It got a lot of nominations.
Yeah,
correct?
It did.
Steven Spielberg's Youth.
Well, he's a front. People think he's a front runner, at least for best director. No? Yes? What?
I don't know.
I don't know.
It's like the political campaigns. It's too early to tell because so much will change between
Who's
now
hosting
and then.
This? Is Jimmy Kimmel?
Jimmy Kimmel.
I like Jimmy Kimmel. Has he ever hosted these? I don't even know.
I think he has.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know.
When is that? Do you have any idea when that is?
That is coming up on.
Well, obviously it's coming up. But when is it? Do you have any idea? He doesn't know this either. Okay.
I forget. March 12th. March 12th.
Fine. Go ahead.
I was going to say the Whale was kind of controversial, right? How did that fare? The Whale is about a very, very heavy man. Apparently, the Whale is not a reference to his size, but it is about a man.
Well, it's both. Yeah. It's a reference to his love of Moby Dick and how he's trying to teach this, but also to his size. And there are comparisons about, you know, being this way in society. But Brendan Fraser, who people have been talking about from the beginning, he is among these first-time Best Actor nominees. And Hong Chau, who I had raved about after I saw the film, who plays his best friend in the film, she got a nomination for Best Supporting Actress. So it wasn't completely shut out like other films like Babylon and The Women King.
Well, you know, one of the before we leave this topic, and we're a little tight today because we went a little long with Larry Cretion there. You're supposed to do snubs. Everybody's supposed to do snubs, but you say they got it right. So while I'm sure there were a couple, Basically, they did what they should have done.
Essentially, they're always going to be. Everybody's surprised about Nope not getting anything. Everybody's a little bit surprised, right?
Oh, yeah, I didn't think of that.
That was kind of glaring. Everybody thought that Brad Pitt would get one for Babylon.
Yeah.
I was surprised it didn't. Babylon didn't get more. I really like that, but it was largely shut out.
Can I ask you a question before we this Murano thing? I was there a couple of years ago, and I was just totally wild. I want to make sure the exhibit in Mystic, right?
Yep.
It's not closing before next week.
No, we can talk about it next week. Yep.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay. By the way, just one very quick thing.
Yeah.
I was surprised at Top Gun. You wouldn't think The Maverick would be the kind of movie that would get nominated for Academy
Award. No, it's just what I said. That's why they expanded to 10.
Yeah.
So they can have the high budget thing so people who'd never watch the show anymore watch the show. Isn't that the reason?
But is that it?
It's pretty commercial. Yeah. That's exactly
They make the Academy. I didn't even know this till yesterday, but it's obvious. They make a huge percentage of their annual revenue from the show. And if nobody watches the prior year, they can't charge X for ads. And if they can't charge X, they don't make whatever. Yeah. Okay. What are you doing on whatever you call it? Open Studio.
Open Studio. We're looking back at a bunch of artists we profiled before. Jacob Lawrence, Sonia Clark, Rob Pro-Black Gibbs, and Amani Willett.
Yeah. You know, Gibbs, did you see, I don't know if we talked about this, Gibbs was quoted regularly in a wonderful piece that I think it's NBC 10 did the night before The Embrace. He was really thoughtful and great. I mean, he really nailed it, and particularly with all the BS controversy, as far as I'm concerned, about The Embrace after the fact. People should go back and watch that. I thought he caught exactly what the artist was trying to do, and I love the thing. So, nice to see you.
Good to see you.
Nice
Thank
to see
you,
Jared.
Too. We were just speaking with GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen, who hosts Open Studio with Jared Bowen on GBH2 Friday nights at 8:30. He also co-hosts when Jim or I are out. Coming up, our food policy analyst Corby Kummer joins us. He's going to talk about fad diets, when them really work, and the fate of Cape Cod's lobster pot. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Sorry. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marj Regan, Jim Bradley. We're joined now on Zoom by Corby Kummer. Corby is the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at the Great Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hey there, Corby.
Hey there.
Hey there.
So, Corby Kummer, let's start with a story about the corporate cafeteria. Remember before the pandemic, Jim, we had a big, huge cafeteria here across the street at GBH?
Well, it wasn't ours. It was like a cafeteria where you had to pay and everything, right?
Yeah, but it was in the building.
Yeah.
You could go there and you could get
a
hot lunch if you wanted to.
And
a lot of people were there,
too.
Really nice tables and everything else. Well, corporate cafeterias like that, or cafeterias, if you want to call it, in a big building, office building, they're kind of done. So what happens now?
Well, first of all, you guys were ahead of the wave. Because right now, if cafeterias exist, it's mostly shared. Other people are allowed in. And often they can pay a very modest subsidized rate for good hot food. So did WGBH work out a special deal? Because that's the way it's working for some of these shared cafeterias in big office buildings, and then for others, they're just inviting in the public. So it's like a terrific low-price restaurant.
I'm happy to say I can't answer either question. One, the prices were cheap. So maybe it was subsidized. And two, I don't know if you needed to show, but we need to show a badge to get in the building. I don't know if you needed to show a badge to get up to the cafeteria. Do you, Marjorie?
We've turned into brown baggers since the pandemic, so I don't know anymore what goes on. Jim comes in with 7 Tupperware containers.
Okay, let's not do this again. I do come in with 7 Tupperware containers, and the food is good, and you usually eat part of it. So let's move on. You know, but the issue...
A big part of cafeterias is the interaction and the socializing.
That's
so
right.
If you would take your 7 Tupperware containers...
Not a chance.
...to a group... place. You don't have to share them. Promise.
No, I'm not talking to anybody either. So forget that.
Hey, human being.
But the reason this is so important, it is fairly important, is in an era when there's such a huge employee shortage everywhere, the concept behind a corporate cafeteria was, particularly free ones, it's a wonderful perk that's going to get people to come here. The importance of it coincides with its decline because fewer people come to work at the exact same time, it's harder than ever to recruit people. So what I took away from this endless New York Times story, which is far too long as far as I'm concerned, it's probably one of his good friends who wrote it. It was fine.
It's everything you could ever want to know.
So what are companies doing now if they can't afford, because there are fewer workers there, to do a cafeteria as such? Are they subsidizing meals? By the way, I have to say, I'm acting like it's those people. Marjorie knows I will go to Ohio for a free lunch. So the notion of, you know, somebody giving me a free sandwich or is an employer is a really attractive kind of thing, Corby.
So what they're trying to do with the spaces, if they were very nice spaces, they're turning them into recreation spots. So they're putting in actual cocktail bars or coffee bars, or remember the WeWorks, which all had beer taps that would only start working like at 5?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was part of what you were paying for. You could go in and in the morning the taps would be cold brew coffee and nitro brew coffee. So they're turning them into socializing spaces. The idea is get people to interact with each other, because that's the point of going to an office now. It is not to get work done. It is to pick up gossip and work with new people and form new alliances. So the way of the dodo is going to be full service, everyday, cheap meals. It's too expensive to run these things. They're just stopping.
You know, Corby, there is yet another story in the spirit of Noma. We've talked about Noma, I think, 2 weeks in a row. This is the Copenhagen restaurant. Am I pronouncing it right, by the way? Noma, right?
N-O-M-A? It's pretty easy at Noma.
Noma, okay, yeah. In Copenhagen, closing at the end of 2024, supposedly the greatest restaurant in the world, according to many, one of the greatest chefs in the world, changed lots of norms in the business. Well, Vivian Howard, who I'm guessing you probably know too, wrote an op-ed. She owns something called Chef and the Farmer, I guess in Deep Run, North Carolina. She's essentially writing the same piece, saying even though her average meal was $60 rather than $500, as she says, per person at Noma, the end of a certain kind of restaurant, the end of that era is upon us. What's happening? Is this a function of COVID, recessions, people scared to go out? What are we observing in the restaurant business?
What we're observing is that workers want to stick up for themselves. They won't be mistreated anymore, and they can afford to get jobs someplace else. I mean, with the new tech layoffs that are sort of bringing an end to a lot of the tech places like Google that was pioneering fabulous organic food every day, and people not coming in, that's ending. But still, there are alternatives to jobs that are essentially abusive and pay you much too little for much too much work. I mean, one of the things she says at the beginning is, while guests sipped and savored their painstakingly created foodie fever dreams, the people behind the scenes got slammed. Or to apply some of the other words we use to describe our experience as we put together yours, we got crushed, pummeled, and murdered. So she goes on to talk about the paper-thin margins,
yeah,
the incredible amounts of labor. With the big part of the Noma story was the huge criticism that that restaurant got for employing 30 unpaid interns every month. When they started paying them, it was to the tune of $50,000 extra on their payroll a month. They couldn't keep that up. Plus, it was wrong, this kind of exploitation. So Vivian Howard writes about this beautifully. And a couple of things to note about her restaurant, which I never went to, Chef and the Farmer, but friends and Durham kept trying to get me to come down because it was the place to eat in the entire country. It was a destination restaurant. First, she made her reputation by being a TV star. She got to be the host of a couple of TV series. That's why people would beat a path to her door an hour away from the Research Triangle cities. And it was evidently a flawless experience, but it was still only $60. That's relatively low compared to $500 for Noma, $400 minimum at 11 Madison Park in New York, but it was still not paying her bills at all. So the fact she was able to succeed in the first place, it was from TV and media exposure, which is still an important part. Look at around Tiffany Faison, look at, you know, various Boston chefs who become established because of TV and media. But she's just decided she can't keep up morale. Any fine dining restaurant that requires that much labor is going to be a bad investment. She started a burger joint and another fast food place down the place. And she said, People don't come to work for Vivian Howard, the TV star in parentheses that she doesn't put in, and want to flip burgers. You know, they come for the kind of experience of learning something, going back home, and she couldn't afford to keep doing that, and it was unsustainable. What I'm really interested by is at the end of this piece, which very eloquently puts out the problems with running a fine dining restaurant, she says she has a new model, and she's going to have a lot of takeout restaurants, these foodie fridges, what does she call post-pandemic, the idea of freestanding, strategically located smart fridges that will offer meal kits, that offer high margins. I was just talking to, you know who it is? It's A.R. Muir, the incredibly inventive, fantastic entrepreneur who started Clover Food Labs. And he was saying that meal kits took off so much during COVID that now they do them every night. They have, I can't remember, Pizza Monday, Vegan Tuesdays. They've got a different night of the week. They're so, it's such a successful model that Vivian Howard thinks she can use it to sustain her reopened fine dining restaurant in which the chefs will serve everybody food, not servers.
Right. Lower cost, fewer workers. By the way, before we leave the topic, Marjorie, one thing I want to say, we discussed this with you last week, but if people weren't listening, the best thing I've read about exploitation of workers, particularly interns, what we talked about last week. Rob Anderson, who's a fabulous writer, who's the co-owner of my favorite restaurant in Provincetown, The Canteen. Check it out. It was in The Atlantic. Was it not in The Atlantic?
I insisted that we talk about that on air, James.
I know.
Thanks
it's great.
Very much.
It was great. No, I'm not. It's great.
No, I didn't bring it into The Atlantic, but he's a great writer. And
he's great.
He talks about, as Vivian Howard does, the difficulty for both the owner and the workers in the system. So everybody's miserable.
May I ask you one quick question, though? She talks, Vivian Howard, in this piece about the paper-thin margins. We hear this all the time about restaurants. They're making their money in the liquor. But a lot of restaurateurs become multimillionaires. So
some.
Considerable numbers of them do really well. So what is that about? Many restaurants or lower quality or
really high prices in some restaurants too, by the way, really high prices in some.
Think of some place like Grill 23 or Davio's. I'm trying to think of the very local chains and Legal Seafood in its day. It's now been sold. They had first enormous tourist trade, second constant repeat business dinners and business lunches and big groups. Grill 23 all private rooms for business conferences, and they had, you know, a huge reputation for that. There's always alcohol in it. But when you have group dinners, you can control your costs much more than an a la carte meal with like many, many options. You know exactly how much food to order. You can control your margins much better. So it's attracting big repeat business. I don't know how that's going to fare post-COVID.
You know, Corby, we had your friend Tamar Haspel from The Washington Post, who wrote a great book. What's the name of that book? What's the name of her book about essentially growing all your own stuff?
Yes.
I have to say, I went in totally skeptical and came out not quite ready to do it, but totally open mind. Why are you making a face? You're trying to think. One of my coworkers will come up with a title.
Something like "Dig This," but it's about
grow your own.
Yeah, I was enthused for several minutes, and I realized it was an absolute impossibility.
Well, by the way, you've been a big gardener. Well, big is a little bit of an exaggeration.
I'm a tiny gardener, and I can barely do the flowers.
And sometimes I'm a Chauncey gardener, so let's move on from that. Thank you very much. One of my favorite films. Thank you. Corby enjoyed that
Being
anyway.
There.
That's one of the funniest films maybe ever. 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 So she writes a piece, "To Boldly Grow," thank you, "Finding Joy Something and Dinner in Your Own Backyard."
I'm not quite there, soon.
But it's a great book. Yeah, I'll find it in my backyard if that's where the delivery person leaves it off. Right. Okay, as I was saying, she basically writes, correct me if you disagree with this, that I've been on about a million diets in my life. I know neither of you ever have, but I've really been on every diet ever created.
Weight Watchers, 36 pounds when I was 12.
I do not believe
really?
That for a second. Is that really true?
Wow.
And you've been slim your whole life since?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, in any case.
I've been on diets.
Okay, you have not.
I have too.
No, that's only when you were stoned
all the bread,
out at the ashram in California and you swallowed all the bread before it had risen and your stomach almost exploded. We've had this conversation 1,000 times.
Okay.
That doesn't count as being overweight.
Right.
You're overweight for one day is what it was, Marjorie.
Right.
Okay, fine. Marjorie's embarrassed. She doesn't want to talk about her stomach exploding when she was high. Okay, so as I was saying, as I, what am I saying? Oh,
co-ed fell her, by undercooked bread. It was a tragedy.
That was a Stanford.
She was a very nice young co-ed, okay. They all said.
So the point I was trying to make, because we're going to talk to listeners about this in a minute, she basically says, correct me if I'm wrong, these are all crank diets. These are all BS. Essentially, it's about consuming fewer calories. And if one of these diets gets you to that end point, the consumption of fewer calories, and you lose weight, great. But other than that, they're all gimmicks. Is that a fair a characterization of what she writes?
Yes and no. Okay. That is, she paints a more complex picture, which is that, yes, they're cranks because they seize on one piece of nutritional
That's
evidence.
That's what it was. That's right.
That carbo, that wheat is going to yield polypeptides that bind with opioid receptors in the brain. So that means it's an appetite stimulant. You're going to eat uncontrollably. Or intermittent fasting. So your body has no choice but to tap fat stores. You lose more fat than if you constantly are eating. Blood type diet, which is, I think, ridiculous because it's saying that our ancestors did well, so figure out what our ancestors ate. And then low-carb keto, insulin's the key to fat storage. Don't eat carbs. You won't release insulin. You store less fat. What she says is you can back that all up with scientific evidence, but what you can't back up is what's its effect on the entire body, The entire digestive system. And so by using this, what she calls science-y language.
I like that. That's good, yeah.
These fad diets, first of all, you sell books, especially in January. And second of all, what you're doing is saying anything you restrict. It's all fruit and grapefruit. I'm thinking of the Miami Beach diet. You cut out carbs and it's all meat. Anything you cut out of your diet is going to cut out calories and you will lose weight. The diets all work. It's not that they don't work. You will lose weight. The question is, what becomes a pattern that you can keep up after January, after March?
Well, I want to know, Corby, since you said you lost 36 pounds when you were 12 years old.
Really,
so
impressed.
That would imply you were a chubby child. You always hear if you were a chubby child, you're doomed to chubbiness your whole life. Obviously, that's not true in your case. So
and it wasn't true in my brother's and sister's cases, because by the time they were 14 to 16, they all gained weight in the second grade. They all lost it between the ages of 14.
Amazing.
So what was that about? Was it about changing your eating habits, or it was just
it
a
was
growth
about they
spurt?
Were older, they'd already gotten thin, and I didn't want to wait around.
Huh.
Wow.
Oh, so it was just like outgrowing your baby fat kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know why, but it was the group effort, and it was being reinforced and supported by a group every week.
Okay.
And it was just the general rallying, being together, cheer, sort of like people would eat better if they saw Jim Brody with his 7 Tupperware containers, if he would actually socialize while he was eating them.
Well, let me tell you something. If I were to socialize, I would tell you that I have very little street cred. But the only street cred I can think of that I have is, here's a guess for you. You're of a certain age, Corby. I used to work when I was a young lawyer at the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility. It was a women's prison outside New York City. And one of the women there was a woman by the name of Jean Harris.
Jean Tardauer.
No, well, Harris, her, right.
Harris.
Why was she there, Corby Kummer?
Because she murdered Herman Tardauer.
Who is he?
Diet doctor.
The complete Scarsdale medical diet. Jean Harris murdered her ex-lover, the famous Scarsdale diet.
The headmaster of the Madeira School.
And by the way, and what she did in prison, the murderer of her ex-lover, the diet doc, is she became an incredible mentor and teacher for all the young women in the prison. She was an amazing, I mean, she was a murderer, but so I'm not downplaying that, but she was an amazing woman who did a lot of good things after she did a very bad thing. So that's the end of that story. Corby, it is a joy for all of us to talk to you. Thank you.
And you.
Can't believe he's kept 36 pounds off.
I know.
If I lose 36 pounds, I gain it back the next day. That's the,
that's what you're about to discuss.
That is what we're about to
discuss.
Thank you,
Corby.
We're
going to hear some good Jim Brody diet stories.
I'm done. I'm done.
But we have been talking with GBA Executive Arts Editor. We've been talking to Corby Kummer, Executive Director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. And up next, we are going to open the lines at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, and talk about diets. Do any of these fad diets really work at all? Are you wasting your time with these fad diets? And a man who knows a lot about fad diets gives a lot of advice on what you should be doing
or not
to fulfill your New Year's resolution, which could be your resolution every year. I'm going to lose 20 pounds.
We know what we're talking
year.
About.
Doesn't quite work out. 877-301-8970 is the number you're listening to Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The number is 877-301-8970 to call or text. We talked about this with Corby just now. There are many diets out there claiming to help you lose weight through a lifestyle change, consume all your calories between these hours. I've done that. Cut out carbs. I've done that. Or gluten. Or Marjorie, can I at least...
Go ahead.
Cut out gluten or plants or meat. I've done that. Or sugar. I've tried that. Juice cleanses. I did that. You're right, by the way. I've done every one of these things. But as Tamar Haspel writes for the Washington Post, she's great, by the way, lives on the Cape. The dirty little secret about losing weight is you just need to eat fewer calories than you expend. So do you agree with Tamar that these crank diets are all full of it? Or have you found a system that really works for you that you'd like to share with others? And why are we even so obsessed with it? Well, I know that question because it's not healthy. If you're happy, I guess some argue, and you're borderline healthy, what value does the number on the scale really hold? I'm not sure you are that healthy if you're, I don't know why you even brought that up. 877-301-8970 is the number. I mean, most diets you do gain the weight back. And I have to say, I like a gimmick because it's easier to follow. I don't know if I'm articulating that well. Having said that, I am aware that on the times of my life when I was grown up enough to say, just count your calories and eat fewer calories, I've done the best. I mean, Haspel's advice has been the most successful with me, but it's also the hardest because you really want to latch on to something, you know, like a thing that is trendy or gimmickry and gimmicky.
Well, it's like you think it's the latest breakthrough.
That's exactly what it is. Right, you're right.
Now we know if you have a certain blood type, you'll do better in your diet or something like that.
877-301-8970. Someone just wrote, oh my God, I totally want to hang out with Marjorie. Oh, and Juliet. I'm sorry. That was in Jim. I was all excited someone actually wanted to hang out with me, but apparently explicitly not me. Where do you want to go?
Okay, let's go to Michael in Virginia.
Hey, Michael, what's your deal?
It's my trifecta, 3 days in a row.
We love having you.
If you want to lose weight, move to Paris.
And why is that again?
Move to Paris because you walk everywhere. Everybody has, there's fresh markets. I was there 2 years ago, and especially in the old town, you got fresh stuff. Everybody walks. Nobody in America walks. I mean, when's the last time you walked from home to work?
I walk to my car every single day and back. So what are you talking about?
I'm sure you do, dude.
Go ahead, Michael.
And I've heard about that car. It sounds kind of cool.
It is kind of cool. Thank you. Just don't touch it, but go ahead.
I'm in my mom's car right now.
You know, Michael, can I tell you something? Can we cut to the chase here? Let me tell you what the problem is. In France, they eat butter and cheese. I mean, that is not it is a lifestyle thing they're doing there. It's not the food. Would you agree with that? Oh, you said it. The walking, etc. It's a lifestyle thing.
It has nothing to do with the food. And, dude, I just got diagnosed with that Lone Star tick, so I can never eat mammal products for the rest of my life.
Oh, that's very sad. That's right. Michael, thank you yet again for a fine introductory call.
You're talking about butter and cheese. I mean, we've had people on the show that have said that
butter's good for you.
No, they haven't said that. That the low-fat diets are a fraud because you never
fill up. Yeah.
So that you might be better off eating a high-fat thing that made you feel full rather than a low-fat thing that had more sugar in it, like yogurt or something that didn't make you feel full. I buy that completely.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing more filling than a spoonful of mayonnaise, Jim.
Yeah, let me tell you, a lot of people just like pop some mayonnaise in. By the way, she does. I mean, for those that's
well, I don't. But you know what is very filling?
No.
A spoonful of peanut butter.
It is.
Very filling. Yeah. Very fatty.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
I mean, by the way, you don't know anything about this. I mean,
okay.
Have you ever, literally, other than that incident we just described, where your stomach almost exploded. Have you ever been 1 pound over in your whole life?
Of course I have.
No, you have not.
But I think a lot
has to do with
your
genes. That. You're not looking
genes.
At me.
I think a lot has to do with your genes.
It does. It does.
Yeah,
it
how you built.
And mine are too tight. That's exactly. Is that the point?
Very good.
Oh, thank you very much. It's an old joke, but fits.
Sally from Cape Cod.
Actually, they're not too tight today. I'm in good shape for a week, maybe.
You are?
And not, well, not really. Apparently, I'm not. Thank you for that endorsement. I really appreciate it. Sally, I'm sorry Marjorie's interrupting you, but go ahead. Hi, Sally.
You mentioned the Scarsdale medical diet.
Yeah.
Yes.
A little bit ago.
Yeah.
I lost 25 pounds on it, four dress sizes when I was in my 20s. I am considerably older than that now.
Yeah.
But the reason that I lost so much was that basically you can eat as much as you want of the prescribed food.
Yeah.
And my husband and I were in graduate school, and so we couldn't afford all the meat, so we just ate a little of the meat, of the expensive stuff, and then I ate all of the vegetables, and I was ending up eating only 800 calories a day, which is why I lost 25 pounds.
So, Sally, let me ask you a question. When Gene Harris murdered the man behind the Scarsdale diet, did that sour your interest in the diet, or did it maintain? How did that affect you?
I was way past having been on it by then.
So the murder didn't affect you.
I was sorry to hear it.
Okay. No, I was sorry. Oh, we were all sorry to hear it. Yeah. Okay. But, well, affected him, but
I'll
okay.
tell you.
Yeah.
It's bad. It's a bad. It's a bad diet that did not teach me anything. When I started eating carbs again, I started gaining weight, and so I
But Sally, you lost weight when you had 800 calories. 800 calories is not enough to sustain yourself. I mean, I don't mean to tell you years later.
That's my point.
Okay. Oh, well, then fine. We're in agreement. Sally, thank you much for the call.
800 calories. Boy, that's nothing.
Like I just had 800 calories in the last segment when we're talking to Corby. We have perfected, by the way, we shouldn't tell you, this probably violates our contract. We have perfected most of the time, not all the time, so don't send us texts, is the moving your mic to a certain angle so you can pop something in during the show.
I get a lot of complaints about
that. You do?
Yes.
Well, you're not as skillful as it is. No, you're not. I mean, the technology.
You're breathing too heavy into the microphone. We can hear you chewing. I hear these things
really?
All the time. Yeah, I do. I feel terrible about it.
It's very sad. It's Marjorie.
Someone said they lost 24 pounds and last year and kept it off using that Noom thing. You see advertised
on television. It says it's a psychological thing.
That's
what it says in the ads. I don't know anything about it.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, let's go to Logan.
Logan in Fitchburg.
Hey,
hi.
Logan, what's going on?
Hey, Jim.
Yeah?
Jim. You can't just drop bombs and not let the people know what's going on. You said Marjorie ate a bottle and her stomach almost blew up while she was stoned.
It did.
Need the details.
Well, I'll give you the details. I wasn't there, Logan. We have a bad connection. Got to let you go. She was working in an ashram.
Ashram.
Yes, she was.
I lived in a house in California
where
we all cooked our own food. That's
okay,
right.
Fine.
And every night there would be like 12 loaves of hot bread that would come out of the oven.
Sure.
Probably my favorite food in the world is bread and butter.
Butter.
So, you know, I did have an occasional bong when I was at Stanford. And you're stoned and you want to eat. So I would eat the bread as it came out of the oven with butter and honey on it. And sometimes the bread hadn't all the way cooked.
Risen yet.
Yeah, it was still rising.
So it rose in your stomach.
So I ate all this bread, and it was rising in my stomach, and I was afraid that my stomach would explode.
Yeah, which would have been horrible.
And I would disgrace my parents, and I would have been the headline. Yeah.
What was the headline again? Co-ed what?
Co-ed fell by exploding bread.
Stomach exploded.
Stomach.
That would have been really
would have been embarrassing.
Horrible.
That's what happened.
Okay, so Logan, that's all you need to know. And that's,
but I didn't obviously
I think it
explode.
Had something to do with the ashram, but she denies it. So, Logan, thank you for your question, though. We appreciate it. 877-301-897. You know what the problem is? The cure, before you tell us what you're laughing at, you know what the only diet is that makes sense? I mean, people, this is really unsatisfying. Moderation is really
moderation.
Moderation.
Well,
is
you know
the
what
key.
I think, seriously? I think what people kind of lost just don't eat anymore when you're full. I think we've kind of lost that. People eat because
it's something. No, only when you're hungry. It's the flip of that. You're only supposed to eat when
yeah,
you're hungry.
Yeah, only eat when you're hungry.
And by the way, I want to say, I want to speak to that. And I was hungry in 1997. I remember it. And I remember it like it was yesterday. It was March. It was a cold day. The wind was blowing fierce.
Okay, a texter wants to know, Jim, how is the bacon of the month diet?
You know what's, by the way, Marjorie, for new listeners, Marjorie sends me, I mean, let's talk about what her motive might be. This year it was salami of the month. She sent me 13 salamis on one day instead of one every 13 months.
I made a mistake.
And that was like 6 weeks ago, and there are none left. So that's number one. Two, my co-host, what does this say about her? Before she sent me salami of the month, sent me a pound and a half of bacon a month, and the prior gift was not a salami. What was the other
sausage.
Thing? Sausage of the month.
You
what do you think her agenda
loved it.
Is?
You
I did
you
love
wanted it.
It,
and so I followed your.
I
you said that's what you wanted for Christmas.
Excuse me, I'm not saying I didn't want it. I would say, what is the motivation of somebody who sends that to a coworker? I would say it's not all noble.
Trying to make their coworker happy. Next year, Jim, I'll send you broccoli at the month.
Can I tell
you
something? Other than, first of all, processed food is really horrible for you. All
Very
three
bad.
Of those.
Horrible.
Big time processed.
Horrible.
Having said that, stop saying having said that, Jim. A bacon has not many calories. Now, if you eat 12 slices, it's got a lot of calories. But if you eat a slice or put it on like a chicken salad sandwich with, you know, low-fat mayo, you're doing okay there. What do you like?
Paul from Worcester says, try the COVID diet. Pretty much nothing but matzo ball soup, tea with honey and lemon for 2 weeks. And he's lost weight and he's completely over COVID.
By the way, Bess, I said this when she was on the air when one of the Rachels was here. Mamala has the best matzo ball soup I've had since moving to Boston 3 decades ago or whatever it was. David in a car. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Long time, many time.
We love you for that. Thank you.
So my wife and I came across a book from Mark Bittman. It's called VB6.
He's great. Go ahead.
He's really great. And basically, you know, I won't go into the fundamentals of, you know, his rationale on it. But, you know, you eat vegan during the day, and then at dinner time, you can pretty much eat what you want. You know, not like, you know, go to the buffet and, like, eat 6,000 calories. But my wife and I both lost significant weight. I lost about 35 pounds.
Wow.
It's a lifestyle change. And not only that, but I was taking allergy medication because I'm allergic to cats and we have 3 cats, so
oh
go
my
figure.
God.
But anyway, after I went on the VB6 plan, I never had to take another allergy pill ever again. So there's something
wow.
in there. You know, maybe it's because you're not eating so much animal during the day. And not only that, but now, because of your show, thank you very much. The Dumpling Daughter book that I bought for my wife for Christmas, we've been incorporating some of the vegan stuff during the day and actually graduating it into the nighttime using that book for some really fabulous recipes. So it's, you know.
Well, by the way, Dumpling Daughter, for those who don't know, Sally Ling, who is legendary, and her daughter, who is Dumpling Daughter, were with us a few weeks ago. Tomorrow, by the way, with Irene Lee from Maymay's, we're going to make dumplings, Marjorie and I, or at least going to attempt it in studio. David,
what's the name of the book?
I can tell you, it's the VB, V
as
in Victor, vegetarian, B as in, what does the B stand for? Beef? What does B stand for?
VB6. It's vegan before 6 p.m.
Oh, vegan before 6 p.m. Oh, that's great. VB6 cookbook, the great Mark Bittman, formerly of the New York Times.
Yeah.
David, that was
a great
thing. Thank you for calling.
Thanks,
really appreciate
so much,
it. And
and
congratulations
you,
on your
David.
Success on the weight front there. That's great.
You know, we have several people that are big fans of Weight Watchers.
I think, you know why? It's moderation. Weight Watchers is a moderation kind of thing. I mean, that's the basic premise. Like, I was looking a couple of months ago at some of the recipes they have there.
Mm-hmm.
They're recipes for things that I make that I love. It's a less rich, less fattening thing. And I made a few of them, by the way. And they're not as rich and exciting as, you know, the full fat kind of thing. But they're good. They're good and really edible.
Michael Pollan, he does a lot of research on food stuff. He's written a lot of books. Says, this is according to a texter, eat food, mostly plants, not too much.
Yeah, that's his deal. Isn't that his
line? Yeah, that's
his
deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't he also, didn't Mike, we had him in, last time we had him in, wasn't he writing the book about psychedelics? Or was that Michael?
Experimenting with psychedelics for psychological problems and psychological health. And actually, I've heard more and more about that in low dose
so
under supervision. I mean,
so
you know, this is not to be done in your own kitchen, but under a doctor's supervision, that some people have been helped with depression with that. I don't know anything about
How to
it.
Change Your Mind is the name. I'm just looking it up, is the name of the book we're talking about last time he was here. We have time for one, maybe two. We'll see. Thomas and Quincy, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, guys. How you guys doing today?
We're excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to plug this diet that I've been, like, looking into called the Daily Dozen Diet.
Don't know
this guy, Dr. Michael Greger, who wrote this book called How Not to Die. And, like, it's basically like a whole food plant-based diet, like a vegan diet. But he, like, says, like, oh, you can still eat everything you want as long as you eat your Daily Dozen. But, like, the actual dozen itself, it's, like, 5 servings of vegetables, 3 of beans, 3 of grains. It's just, you get so full eating the stuff in the dozen that you don't have any room left for eating, like, a burger or anything like that.
So how did that work out for you?
Oh, I mean, I'm not following the path as well as I could. But I think it's doing good. I'm trying to get my cholesterol down, and, like, it's working for that, so...
Yeah, the full thing, that makes sense to me. Not that I understand. Well, I mean, that makes sense to me. Thomas, thank you very much for the... There's a lot of interest on the text line about your almost stomach explosion. We should have done the segment on that, actually. And we should have.
It was very embarrassing. But you know something? A lot of people are changing to vegan for environmental reasons.
Well, I know that.
And when I talk to Corby Cumber every week, and he talks about the way animals that we eat are treated and the horrors that pigs go through and chickens go through and beef go through. It almost ruins your appetite for these foods when you see them, you know, in a restaurant menu.
Did I tell you about off the air or was it on the air about my eating experience yesterday when I was off? Was that off the air I told you about this, the plant burger thing?
Yes, you said it was terrific.
Did I say it on the air? I hope I didn't. I didn't. Zoe says I didn't.
We were at Whole Foods.
I was at Whole Foods. The Ink Block, is that what it's called? Where the Herald used
to
be. And a guy comes up to me with chicken nuggets, and I stupidly thought it was a chicken nugget. I ate it. It was, you know, a handout kind of thing. It was fabulous. It was vegan. And I said, that's one of the best vegan things I ever ate in my life. This will please a lot of our listeners who are angry at us for criticizing the quality of vegan food. He said, you should try a burger. I tried a plant cheeseburger. I swear to you, and you know I'm sensitive to taste. To texture in particular, it was as good as like a fast food cheeseburger. And I don't mean that disparagingly. It was good. It was edible. It was good. It was fun. I was shocked. Plant burger over there at, it's the window on the right when you go to the Ink Block Whole Foods. That's
and
it. I'm done.
And they have a parking lot there too.
They do. And it's free parking. That is correct. We're done.
We are done. Thank
Thanks
you very
for
much
calls,
for tuning
everybody.
In to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the calls and the texts. Sorry we can't get to all of them. You can keep up with us 24/7 by way of our podcast. Tomorrow, as Jim said before, we're going to be joined by Irene Lee. We're going to be doing some dumpling making, apparently.
Theoretically.
Also, the Boston Holocaust Museum is working on an incredible exhibit where you'll be able to speak with survivors through pre-recorded interviews with thousands of answers to last generations. Josie Kipnis, co-founder of the Boston Holocaust Museum, Michael Brennenbaum is going to be with the Holocaust Legacy Foundation. They'll both join us, along with a 93-year-old survivor and founder of the Miami Holocaust Memorial, David Schechter. We'll also have NBC's Chuck Todd, Shirley Leung from the Boston Globe, TV critic, with Matthew Gilbert, also from the Globe. We'll take a crash course, as I said, on the dumpling making. Our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Brendan Deedy. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker, with Brian Bell on the board. Our executive producer is Jamie Bologna. Excuse me, I'm Marjorie Egan.
Who are you again?
Marjorie Egan.
Oh, you are Marjorie Egan.
I goofed that up, sorry.
I am Jim Brown. It's only your name. I mean, some names are tough to pronounce.
It is tough. It's not Marjorie. It's Marjorie. Just want to be clear.
See you tomorrow, everybody. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in. Hope you have a great day, and hope you can tune in tomorrow.